I am involved as a volunteer and community advisory board member to help save WBAI. Serving on a number of progressive boards and committees, I am shocked by the acrimony and lack of cooperation exhibited by the current LSB. The stakes for WBAI are high. Change is needed for WBAI to survive and grow. Let's invigorate the LSB with new vision, energy, and purpose. I am not interested in personality conflicts, and I will approach the LSB with a clean slate. Vote for me and other independents, especially Bob Young and Alex Steinberg.
I'm Lynn Stewart.
And I'm Ralph Pointer. I led the campaign to free Lynn.
We're so grateful to all of you who helped win my release.
Now, Lynn and I want to use our decades of movement experience to help save WBAI by joining in a board which must evaluate management, scrutinize the budget, find a program director capable of developing new broadcaster activists, and demand implementation of a sustainability plan.
Please support the entire Justice and Unity slate endorsed by Bernard White and many others.
For unknown reasons, Lynn's online membership didn't register. Please write in Lynn Stewart's name and rank her number one.
You can read my statement at justiceunity.org. Love and struggle.
The views expressed are not those of WBAI management, staff, or current board. To view full candidate statements, visit www.elections.pacifica.org.
I wish they'd hurry up with that transmission. I want to go to France.
I suggest that you reach deep down inside yourself there and try and find something that'll keep you awake just a little while longer, because this transmission coming up may just rekindle your will to live.
It's time Now, where are my people? 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 Where are my people?
Hi, this is from Valley Forge, Berkshire, Sequoia. Valley Forge, Berkshire, Sequoia.
This is Tom Central. Channel open for executive order AUC-3423.
Listen to this, boys.
Now, where are my people? Now, where are my people?
Tell the rain to drop all over me.
Now, where are my people?
Tell the sun to hear my plea.
Now, where are my people?
Tell the wind to carry me.
Now, where are my people? Now, where are my people? The 70 billion people of Earth, where are they hiding? Consuelo, they're not human.
And you don't think it's time somebody had a dream again? You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Tell the wind to carry me. Tell the rain to drop all over me. Tell the sun to hear my plea.
It seems to me that the overall vagueness of your memory suggests that we might clarify them a little. Hypnosis.
Far away.
Would you be agreeable to that?
Hypnosis?
It's a simple process. It's sometimes very helpful in cases of psychological trauma. People have difficulty remembering what happened to them. It's not exactly the electric chair. I'm going to count to 10 as you're falling asleep. And when I'm finished, you'll be deeply, deeply asleep. One, falling asleep. Two, falling asleep. Three, falling asleep. Four, falling asleep. Five, falling asleep.
How long has it been since you've slept?
I don't know.
How long has it been since you've slept? How long has it been since you've slept?
Tired.
And I know I haven't slept since this thing began.
Thank you. night shift.
You can feel it.
Night shift.
It only happens once a week.
Night shift.
It's invisible.
Night shift.
But you can feel it.
Night shift.
Mondays.
Night shift.
I wish they'd hurry up with that transmission. I want to go to bed.
I suggest that you reach deep down inside yourself there and try and find something that'll keep you awake just a little while longer, because this transmission coming up may just rekindle your will to live.
I'm talking about it, and I have no idea. I have no idea. I have no idea why I'm here. I don't know what I'm doing, you know, talking about this. I saw something, they saw something. There was a lot of light. That's all I remember.
Okay, you're tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, and I'm speaking with Noor Armani, who is the founder and artistic director of SR, Socially Relevant Film Festival New York. Noor, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Tell me a little bit about the Socially Relevant Film Festival and what made you start it.
Well, the Socially Relevant Film Festival concentrates on socially relevant films, meaning that the stories we tell are human interest stories that refrain from dwelling upon gratuitous violence, crime, and all the rest of all those terrible things that we see so much of nowadays on our screens, and also that it concentrates on human issues or social issues. It doesn't mean to say that it has, you know, a political agenda, that it advocates hardcore politics and anything like that. It just has to tell a human interest story and be creative and entertaining at the same time.
that basically means then that it can be any genre. It can be drama, it can be comedy, it can be science fiction.
Totally. I'm so glad you brought that up, because people think we're only about documentaries. And I go, no, we have short narratives, documentaries, feature-length narratives. It could be a comedy. We're preparing our third edition, and I'm really surprised, and I'm so happy that I'm saying that, because when I was putting together the first year, I didn't even know, but in October, around like a month from now, I didn't even know if this was ever going to take place, because we didn't have any funding. I was just jumping at it, and I'm saying, I gotta do this, but then, you know, you gotta be realistic too. But fortunately, things happened, people came by, and we found interesting partnerships and so on, and we were able to pull it together. The second year, you start saying to yourself, oh my God, am I going to be able to repeat the same experiment? And then you do, and then you're so happy. I think this third year, everybody tells me, is the critical year, when finally you prove to yourself and to everyone else that maybe you know what you're doing, so it's working, hopefully.
You know, you said, you know, I have to do this. I mean, you're an artist, you're an actress, you've done all kinds of things. Why is it that you felt so compelled to go so out of your comfort zone to do something so challenging?
Well, that's really interesting. And I had organized film festivals or curated or guest curated film events in the past, but not done a film festival from scratch. So this is completely a different beast. And when I was doing one of those last ones, I had said to myself, never again, because it's so much work. It takes you away from your art and creation and acting and all that. But I felt this has to be done, because I was, you know, really getting tired of seeing so much violence on screen. Plus a personal story, something that happened to me. My cousin and my uncle were victims over 10 years ago. It's going to be 12 years soon. It was in 2004. They were murdered because of a hate crime, a religious hate crime.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And I was like, really, I felt, you know, a way to commemorate their memory, but at the same time, in a meaningful way, to show that violence doesn't pay and we need to concentrate on real human issues.
Mm. Well, now, the event that's happening Wednesday is essentially a fundraiser, and it's for people who want to be supportive of the arts, for people who want to be supportive of the festival. Tell me what it's about and what do people get if they do support.
Sure. This is our first event of this year. It's the kickoff fundraiser for the third edition. And it's a three-course dinner paired with wine and a nice cocktail reception with
wow.
a short film screening at Monty's Italian restaurant down in Greenwich Village. It's going to be a fun evening with red carpet. People will be interviewed on the red carpet about their views on what they think is a socially relevant film and why they want to support this festival. And we would be more than happy to get to know and chat and exchange ideas with the people who think alike and who think that socially relevant films need to be supported.
Well, I have to say this. I think that film is probably the most powerful storytelling meeting ever. And I think you can reach more people in a faster and more powerfully than any other storytelling medium we've ever had. So socially relevant films, I think, has more than a significant place within
yeah.
what we do as human beings in terms of telling stories.
At any given moment in the day in our lives, we are always attached to some form of screen. It's either the computer or the television, or we are in a movie theater, or we are holding onto our phones and looking
That's
at
true.
A screen. You know? So images are really very powerful, and images that tell a story are even more so. And that's how we engage people. That's how we get them to understand about the important things and what's going on and how they can make a difference. That's about it. That's about making a difference in the world and feeling that everybody can make a difference.
There are films that have actually changed things. There are films that have actually not only changed people's perspective, that have changed, that have encouraged laws to happen, that have helped catch criminals. There have been all kinds of socially relevant films that have made a difference.
Totally. I totally believe in that. And just as we can make a socially relevant positive change or difference, I'm also a strong believer that negative image can also have a negative effect. So the idea is to stay away from all that is negative and promote positive images and tell stories that inspire, that excite young people to do good and to do human gestures and things that make a difference and make our lives and for future generations a lot better.
And you have something special for our listeners.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The event is Wednesday, by the way, Wednesday the 30th of September. It's a three-course dinner. It's $125, but I'm making a special, we're offering a special partner special because WBAI was one of our media partners on the festival, and we're so excited to have them again on the third edition. And it's a $30 discount on the tickets. And when you go on Eventbrite, which is where the tickets are sold, it's an event called Back to White, because, you know, it's like all those white parties,
right,
past Labor Day. So we're doing Back to White party. And by using the code FM, like FM, the radio FM, 15, because we're 2015. F capital, M capital, 15. It will give you the access to the special WBAI discount rate.
So if they go to Eventbrite, what do they do? Now, I'm going to put this on the Night Shift Facebook page so that people can go from there. But if they just want to go online, what do they search
if they
for?
Just
what
should they go online? Google? Yeah, they can do www.backtowhite.eventbrite.com, and it will get them to the page where they can know more about the event and purchase the tickets. And then when it says, do you have a discount code or something, as they're checking out, if they do FM15, they will get that discount.
Fantastic. And Eventbrite, just for those who are listening, is BRITE, if you've never done Eventbrite.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, Nora, I look forward. Now, I will be there myself.
That's right. I was just going to say that. The most important point is that Mike is our guest of honor at the event, and he will be addressing the audience, whoever is present. And we're also showing a short film and a small presentation on the festival, a short trailer about the past festival selection.
I can wear my white jacket.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. The dress code is dress in white to show your support for peace, world peace.
That's right.
I really, really hope it happens.
And I'm sure you'll have plenty of napkins if you're wearing white. So
that's a good one. Yeah, of course. The restaurant can loan you a white, you know, sheet or napkin or whatever, toga. You'll wear a toga.
Wear a toga when you come, just so you don't mess up your white outfit. Well,
yes.
Thank you very much, Nora. I look forward to seeing you, and I'm sure I'll have you back again when the festival actually happens.
Thank you so very much. And maybe on the website, you can also mention the website in case people want to know.
Yes, what is the website?
www.ratedsrfilms.org.
All right, and if you go to the Night Shift Facebook page, we'll put all that on there too. So
great.
Thank you,
Thank
Nora.
Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to this.
Oh, my.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI. The name of the show, Night Shift. Jenny Karakaya.
Yes.
How are you?
I'm great.
So it's just you and me, Jenny. You've been, since the last time you were here on the show, how many different countries have you been to now? Or how many different states?
I was in Turkey, Greece, think that's about it. Oh, France. Let's not forget France.
Let's not forget France. Now, do you want to say why you were in Turkey or Greece?
Well, Turkey was to visit my family.
You weren't undercover.
We can't tell anybody. I was visiting my family in Turkey, and Greece was purely for pleasure, as it always is when you visit Greece.
I understand. Well, that's such a statement. Greece was for pleasure, as it always is when you visit Greece. I understand. So, okay.
And France was part work, part fun.
Well, that's the best way to go to France. So, and were in France? Were you in Paris or in like the French Riviera?
No, the French Riviera.
Of course you were.
Excusez-moi.
You were the croissant.
I had plenty of that.
Yes, of course you did. All right. And that was all during the summer?
That was all throughout the summer. Wow. And I can't believe it's fall already.
I want to have a Jenny Caracalla summer where I go to France, Italy, Turkey.
Well, you know, when you're not working, you have to enjoy life.
I feel you.
And my greatest pleasure is travel. So I work to live.
I understand. Well, see, I didn't go anything half as exotic. I went to Hawaii and, you know,
Oh, please.
Not as exotic as Paris or Greece.
I would like to think Hawaii is considered exotic.
It's nice.
It's far.
It's nice. It's far.
It's
far.
Close to the Polynesian.
It's
considered exotic.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. All right, so I'm going to tell you what our theme is. We have a few interviews this morning. I have the interviews for a few very, very interesting films that I will highly suggest to you. We just had a conversation with Nora Armani, who is the artistic director and founder of the Socially Relevant Film Festival. And there's an event on Wednesday. And if you go to the Night Shift Facebook page, you can find out all about it. And I'm going to have an interview with the director of a film that we both saw called Wildlike.
Mm-hmm.
Did you enjoy that film?
I very much so.
Okay, all right. So we're going to talk about Wildlife. And there's another film, really fascinating film, coming out called Becoming Bulletproof. Did you read about that?
I did, and I watched the trailer, and I have to say it's very unique.
It's unique, and it's moving. I mean, you literally will be brought to tears, but you'll also, you know, smile and laugh. It's a really moving film. It's about a camp for filmmakers, where they make a feature film every year, but they're all disabled in some way. But they all get together and they have volunteers or people who are working. Nobody gets paid. Everybody does it on a complete volunteer basis. And they were working on a Western, and a documentary was made about it. And I have to tell you, it is
inspiring.
It's inspiring as an artist. It's inspiring just as a humanitarian.
Did you cry?
I did. I'm going to be honest. You know, there were tears happening.
There were tears
happening. So I have an interview with the director of that film. It's called Becoming Bulletproof, which just opened this past Friday. And the co-founder of the organization, his name is Will Halby. And he, you know, when you see him, he looks like, who was it who played Two-Face in the Batman movie? Aaron Eckhart. He looks like Aaron Eckhart's, like, twin brother. You know, it's interesting, but
it's his other face.
It's totally his other face, but he, you know, he's devoted his life to doing this camp. He's had it for like 12, 13 years now. So it's very inspiring on many levels. And if you love movies, like, it's a good movie. It's fun. The movie they're making, you get. It's a lot of fun.
I love the sense of humor and
it's a lot.
It had a lot of heart. You could see that. I definitely want to see the film.
It's worth seeing. I'll hook you up. And Wildlife we're going to talk about. So that, and we're going to also talk about the brain.
The brain.
The brain. We're going to be talking about
whose brain?
Your brain, my brain, people's brains. I have brain stories, brain information, and I have a couple of brain questions for you.
Oh, God.
Now, here's the big question for you, okay? You know there's a type of person that is, you know, turned on by intellect. You've heard of that?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Of course.
And
I'd like to think most of us are.
Come on, let's be realistic, okay?
I can't say that for men.
Here's my question to you in terms of the power of the brain or the attractivity of the brain. If you had to choose between a really good-looking guy who's kind of dumb or a really brilliant, great conversationalist, really fascinating, interesting guy who's really not, just doesn't do it for you. He's not an ogre, but he's just not, like, you know, you're not getting excited.
He's not the hottest one in the bunch.
He's not the hottest one in the bunch, right. Well, so, which would you choose? Honestly, now.
Well, no pun intended, this is a no-brainer.
Okay.
I would definitely go for the man with the intellect.
Oh.
Because I've been in the situation.
You've been in the other.
And I have to tell you.
You've tried it both ways.
Hot gets boring when there's zero conversation. You can only go so far.
Hot gets boring.
It does. Gotcha. It's pretty to look at, but if there's no mental stimulation, and I mean, really, what can you do with that?
No, listen, I really
You'd enjoy it for a week.
Yes, you would. Yes, you would. And I wish we could take calls like we used to, and I'm going to set it up so that we can. Hey, Chris, are you there?
Yes.
Now, Chris, you remember Jenny, yes?
Hi, Jenny. How are you?
Hi, Chris.
So, Chris,
How was your whirlwind tour of the world?
Well, it wasn't the world. It was only Europe, but it was wonderful.
Yes. It was. Remember, she went to Greece for pleasure, as it always is when you go to Greece.
But she has the attitude. She's like, hey, you know what? If I'm not working, I'm going to enjoy life.
No, I totally agree. Like I said, I want to have a Jenny Karakaya summer. But now, here, Chris, I'm going to ask you the same question. And you're a man, and men, you know, and I want you to be honest. Don't like,
oh, man,
front.
I can.
Is this a no-brainer? You can hang with you. Right,
yes, I want to hear this from a man's perspective.
Yeah, right.
I
should have realized. Chris is not going to be honest. Chris.
I can hang with both, dude.
Listen. Hanging with both is not the question, okay?
Yeah.
Hanging or playing.
Exactly. Hanging is not the question.
Okay.
That's not the question.
I can hang with both
for a considerable
amount of time.
Oh, whatever. Whatever.
No, yeah. I'm being honest.
Yeah, right. Okay, you hang with one when you're not horny, and you hang with the other one when you are. Come on, that's not really saying anything. It's not saying anything.
No, well, here's the thing.
Beauty over brains or brain over beauty?
He's like, you know, I can always teach her. Go ahead. I want to hear what you're going to say, Chris.
You know, there's an extension to the question, though, you could ask.
Yeah, what you're going to ask it before you answer the question?
How much, you know, how much younger, like, in your age, like, okay.
Listen, whatever you find.
You are not going there.
He has to. He's like a man.
But see, here's the thing.
Go ahead, proto man.
The age thing falls under that category in some respect.
Dude, you don't even have to bring it up. Like, whatever you find attractive.
We're not saying she's going to be 20 years older.
She could be 25 and brilliant and not that hot, or she could be 25 and super hot and not that brilliant. You get to pick the age. It's not a factor.
I understand.
Mm-hmm. You can have whatever millennial you want.
It depends if you're having a midlife crisis or not.
Well,
that's true.
This is true.
Everything depends.
Because at that point, I don't think intellect is going to...
No, but to be honest, I fall into the same category, like, you know, brains over...
Oh, please, listen.
I am your friend.
I'm your friend. I know you.
What do you mean you know me? What are you talking about? All right, what does that
mean? I'm call you a liar in my George C. Scott voice, but... All right, but I'm just going to say, okay, Chris, okay.
We're going to set you up with a few very smart ladies
after this call.
The hard part about this is, I'll be honest with you, though, you know, and I am being honest, but I'll be more than honest further than what you're asking is that, you know, it all depends on who I'm attracted to. You know what I mean? Like, in other words, I'm not really considering, you know, if...
You're saying it's all about an X factor. Is that where
it's
you're going?
Kind of an X factor because the more important thing is that you know, I'm not really thinking in those terms in general. I'm you know what I mean?
You're not really thinking in those terms.
I'm not thinking, oh, wow, you know, it's going to...
Is this
you know,
a beautiful
likely,
human? Is that what you're saying? Is that what you think?
Well, no, it's just, I'm going to, the vibe has to be right. And it doesn't matter.
Jenny,
you know, brains, or I don't know, the vibe. I'm going for the vibe.
We're not really quite sure what this vibe means. What do you mean by vibe exactly?
Yeah.
What do you mean, the vibe that you get when she's moving, when she's dancing? What kind of vibes are we talking about?
Yeah.
When I'm hanging with the person I'm with, the vibe has to be right. Like, she has to get me. And it doesn't matter.
He's not answering the question. He's not answering
well,
the question.
I am answering the question. Doesn't, no, she has to get me. She has to get me and to my core, who I am. It doesn't matter how she looks.
Dude.
Okay, so
that's really the over factor to the whole situation. All right.
So if she's
the real question would be, does she have to be intelligent to get you? And, you know, I can't answer that.
I don't know. I don't know. You know, I don't know how you judge that, really. It's just, it's more a vibe thing. If you vibe with somebody, does the other stuff, I mean, in the end really matter? How do you vibe with a ditzy person?
I just want to know that. How do you vibe with a ditzy person?
You get ditzy. You get ditzy
how
too.
How do you vibe with, oh my God, you're so cute.
Yeah, exactly.
What are we going to do tonight?
Exactly. Listen, this is how you know he's full of, you know, kidneys.
Not.
All right, Chris, I have another question. Here's another
it
brain.
Doesn't matter
I have another brain
if
question.
If I'm not vibing with them, then I'm not going to be with them. So
I understand.
It doesn't really matter. You know what I mean? It's the truth.
Who is it that didn't have a brain in The Wizard of Oz? Which one? Which one didn't have a brain?
I would take the Tin Man.
No, the Tin Man didn't have a heart. It was the straw man.
So you'll
take the straw girl.
Well, of course he will. Because now he's thinking country girl.
Right. Country girl. All right, so he can hang with either one. That's what he said. So, dead giveaway there, Chris, just so you know. All right, so here's the second brain question. I'll ask you first, Jenny. Can you think of a situation in your life where you literally thought your way out of the situation? If you can reveal it.
What do you mean?
Meaning where you were in a situation where you literally just had to figure your way out of it. Like, you didn't see a way, but you figured it out.
You mean mentally?
Mentally.
I figured my way out. It could be a traumatizing...
It could be whatever.
Dramatic point in your life.
It could be, I don't mean emotionally you got through it. I mean, it took your intellect to get through it. Like, you figured it out. You had a problem, and you tackled it mentally.
Oh, God, I have to think about this one.
Well, you can think about
I'm
it.
Sure
you got
I've
time.
Had a few of these situations. Emotionally, definitely, I've had to figure out a lot of things.
That's a whole other thing. That's a whole other navigation.
But sometimes the brain and the heart get entangled.
Yeah, sometimes that's the problem.
Right.
But, and Chris, do you have an answer for the question while Jenny thinks?
Exactly.
You've never thought your way out of any situation, Chris.
No, I think my way out of situations all the time.
I know. Well, I want to hear a particularly,
I think my way out of a situation.
Yeah, where you could call it scheming, you could call it whatever, like just being clever. You know what?
All right, dodged a bullet. Exiting out of my lease with my studio in New York, I guess. I thought my way out of that situation, I guess. That answer? I mean, it was a long period of time. It took a long time. That's one way that I
had to use. And would you say it was pure intellect?
I had to constantly sit there and figure out, you know, what playing chess. It was like playing chess, you know. So, I mean, I don't know. When you go to court and all that stuff and, you know, owe a lot of money and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I guess, I mean, I used my brain power to think what was the alternative to the point where, you know, investigated whether the landlord still, you know, what corporation owned what of the building, you know, went and figured out all kinds of angles so that he could not say that he wasn't really the landlord, because he was like, well, I'm not really the landlord, but he still was the landlord, even though he gave the building to his brother and it was a whole thing. So it was, you know, quite a lot to figure out always which way to go. I don't know if that answers.
Yeah, no, that answers. That's definitely one if that comes to mind.
What about you? I mean, that's the, you know, I mean, I don't really use my brain much more than that.
You know, you didn't answer the question, Mike.
Who, me?
Yes,
well,
and the last question either.
Well,
yeah,
you
why
know,
don't you answer the last question? Because that's the important one.
I can answer the last question. Well, for me, it would have to be intellect, because I, too, have tried both, and, you know, yeah, you know. Because you're going to spend a lot more time dealing with the intellect than you are the physical.
Absolutely.
You know, and, you know, there's always room for improvement, you know. So if, you know, I think, again, you know, it does come down to, I will agree with Chris, you know, chemistry is clearly a big factor. You have to have chemistry with somebody. But, you know, yeah, it's got to be intellect. Because, you know what, I need somebody who's going to challenge me.
Absolutely.
I have to be challenged. I enjoy having, the best relationships for me are the ones where I come away, I learned something too.
Mm.
You know, mm-hmm. I gave something mm-hmm. and I came away with something.
Right.
Ongoingly. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So, yes. Now, the physical is wonderful, but you know what? Once you have something real, you can always look. There's movies, there's, you know, that's just physical. Does that make sense?
Well, we're surrounded by beautiful
things. Exactly. We're surrounded by beautiful things.
We can look at beautiful things all day long.
Exactly. Thank you. Hello.
You just go to the land of Barbies in L.A. and you're surrounded by...
The land of Barbies. Yes. Christy, let's go to the land of Barbies. I'd like to visit the land of Barbies.
Wherever the land of Barbie is.
Well, the land of Barbies. That's what, you know...
No, I don't think I would really like the land of Barbies. You know,
on.
You do have to be
you
able
could
to
visit the land of Barbies.
No, the look
don't
thing
lie. You are such
quickly.
A liar. I'm sorry.
Yes, it does. Yeah. It fades quickly, the look thing. You know that.
Yeah, whatever. Whatever.
You know, actually,
that's why you
Mike
keep going younger.
About this. Listen, you want to know the truth? The truth is, for the fifth time, here's the truth again. You know, somebody has to get my jokes. And if they don't get my jokes, then they're not the right person.
Well,
so they have to
there
get my
again
jokes.
Comes into
well, there's there. A difference between getting a joke and just laughing for the sake of laughing to make you feel good. And a lot of women
yes.
have mastered that
oh.
to laugh at
no.
things to make a man
no, you have to
stroke
get
a man's
joke.
Ego.
To
let's
make
giggle a little.
Man, feel funny.
Let's see, Danny. Let's see.
It's all about ego stroking.
Let's see whether you'll get the joke. What about Lieutenant Columbo? Will he understand the situation? You see? Then see? Do you get it? Do you see? She's not laughing. She doesn't get my joke. There it is.
He can clearly only date aliens, is what he's really saying.
Lieutenant Columbo.
Yeah,
Lieutenant Columbo.
He's orbiting
you don't
Pluto
get it.
Right
see,
now.
Lieutenant Columbo.
I don't get it either.
He'll solve. You don't get it either.
I'm
well,
a pretty
he
bright
solve.
Guy, you know, so he couldn't date me. So, all right, we can't date Chris because I didn't get that.
All
so,
right,
you
there
know,
it is.
I didn't get it. But, well, let me ask you, this brings up your age thing, and I really don't want to go there. But, I mean, then if you're with someone too young and you're making references to things they wouldn't get, how does that work for you?
That's my point. That was the point I'm making.
Is that the point you're making? Well, that's not intelligence, though.
No,
so you're
I
saying
know
they
got
to be old enough to understand your references.
Understand the references is what is really what I was trying to get at without even making I didn't make a joke yet, but at some point in the evening I'll make a joke and then we'll be able to compare as to whether or not you guys get it. But you know, if you mention Lieutenant Columbo to somebody, they're not even gonna understand what you're talking about. So you know, it's just 'cause I remember hanging out with some friends of mine and all they wanna do is watch Lieutenant Columbo on DVD. They were like, oh, you're not gonna believe what I have Lieutenant Columbo on DVD, you know. And we sat and watched it. So that just shows you
yeah,
how
you clearly hang with an interesting bunch.
Well, it was interesting. Why? You wouldn't sit and watch the old episodes of Lieutenant Columbo?
You know, I never really watched Columbo.
Clearly, so neither did I. Clearly, neither have
well,
I.
Well, there it is. Well, clearly, I'm in my own league here.
You are.
But it's
I'm in my own
it's
league.
All about Columbo, though.
First of all, you know, all these stars were on the old Lieutenant Columbo shows. It was really hilarious to watch a lot of these. And you, Mike, you talked about this with me. I don't know why you're acting like you didn't.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean I saw them. I know who Columbo is, and I know all these people were on there, and I know
yeah,
famous
you know, well,
people
you were mentioning,
directed
like, the episodes. Like, one of your favorite episodes was blah, blah, blah.
No,
blah,
that
and,
was not me. I
guess it was you.
When the DVD came out, I talked about it.
Wow. Well, there it is.
Perhaps you remember that. But
I
never
I remember
actually,
everything.
I've never actually seen. You know what I actually bought the other day because I'd never seen it? And I was reading about it, and it was like, you know, $6 for two seasons. TJ Hooker. I never saw TJ Hooker. Did Did you ever see the show?
You know,
with William Shatner?
I think when I was a kid, I may have seen a rerun or two.
Right, exactly, but it was on.
But not deliberately. But it came on the TV at some point.
Well, Mike spent the whole weekend watching T.J. Hooker.
No, I didn't watch it. I bought it.
Yeah, you didn't act like you did the whole weekend. You talk about Lieutenant Columbo, but you watched.
No, I didn't.
Is that because Heather Locklear was on it?
No, my God, no. The only reason, actually, I'm obviously a William
She Shatner was fan. On it, right?
She came in end of second season.
Right, I read right up okay, on I got
she
that
comes
right.
She in end of second season. But, yes, she was on it. So was Adrian Zemed, who, you know, only did Bachelor Party, and that was it. But what's interesting is Leonard Nimoy was on the show and directed in a couple episodes.
Really?
So I thought that was interesting, yes.
Interesting.
So, and that was what made me buy it. Like, I was reading about it, and then I was also reading that.
And you got hooked.
I got hooked.
You got hooked.
Hooked on Hooker.
There are a lot of puns tonight.
Yeah, a lot of puns. But no, so I haven't watched it, but I'm curious, because I read that there were four seasons on, like, ABC, and then they canceled it, and then CBS took it for a season. You know? So, there it is. Five seasons.
You have it.
And they've only ever released two seasons.
Huh. Well,
they never
so
released
can you can,
because of
can
low
you
sales.
Buy the other three seasons on
nope,
TV?
They're not available.
Really?
They're
Why
not.
Wouldn't they make it available?
Here's what's interesting. I think
they can make money off of that.
Fox released it. Okay,
cash in.
Like 12 years ago, they released it on DVD. The sales were so low that they didn't release the other six, three seasons. Then
we've only sold seven of them, and Mike Sargent bought one of them.
No, well, then they sold the rights to one of these, you know, TV Land kind of things.
Right, right.
And they released the first two seasons, and that's it. So only the first season. You can get two versions.
I never get why studios shelf these things when they can actually.
Well, they said they didn't make enough money.
Yeah, but they can make money off of the other seasons that have already been recorded. If they release it on DVD or Netflix or something.
Let me tell you something. That's what I was going to say. Netflix. You know, VOD.
Hulu.
Will give a whole new life to all these shows that you've never been able to see. So, because they don't have to manufacture it.
True.
They just have to release it. And that's how all of our, libraries will be in the future anyway.
Hmm.
Like, you have the cloud. You'll always be renting. You won't own anything.
Right.
Everything will be renting. You rent your music. Right. You rent your movies.
Television.
You rent space on the cloud.
Yeah.
Then when you're poor, you don't have anything. You don't have any music. You don't have any belongings.
Right.
There
well,
it is.
Radio's changed as we know it. Music has changed.
Well,
and
radio is being supplanted by Spotify and
And television is changing as well. I mean, eventually.
Well, television's long changed. It's
but what I'm saying is that a lot of these mm-hmm. television networks are going to...
Cable companies will be non-existent.
Yeah, Cablevision just got sold.
Of course. Listen, these cable, it's had its day. It's like the, the horse and buggy.
Right.
Because, people now, why? Why pay, $75 or $150 a month when you pay $7.99 a month and watch what you want when
whatever
you want?
Whatever you want. Apple TV is headed exactly that way.
Well, Apple TV should have done it earlier because that was their idea.
They should have.
They were ahead of the curve, but then other people beat them
Netflix. But Apple's right behind them now.
They're
going to be doing that. Very soon.
Well, I think, Apple has a certain monopoly, because they got a whole ecosystem, but that's a whole other conversation because I'm a former Apple convert.
Right. We're digressing now.
Yeah, we're digressing. So now I do want to, I would like you to read one story before we go to our first interview. And one of the stories, particularly any of the brain stories, you can here. Here's one. This is interesting. Now, Chris, you remember last week or the week before, actually, when Joe and I were here and we had dueling interviews with.
Yes, I thought that was great. By the way,
was it good? Was it interesting?
It was great because what it was, Jenny, was that Mike had interviewed someone and Joe had interviewed the same person.
It was a director of a film called Listen, which is about these kids who invent a device that can read minds.
Oh.
And they're like...
can it really?
Yeah, well, that's what the movie's about. Go ahead, Chris. What were you going to say?
So between both their questioning, you get a really good sense of the film. So it's like... Mike or Joe don't ask necessarily better questions. They just ask different questions, which, they just have different insight. And, you know, so it was really interesting. I mean, I always side that Mike's, you know, always the better interviewer just because I'm going to give Joe a hard time. But because, you know, Mike's been doing this for such a long period of time that he has these questions that no matter what happens, he always gets the same response out of every single person where they go, oh, wow, it's a really good question, you know?
Whereas, that's, you know, my goal when I do an interview.
You know what I mean? He always gets that response. I mean, from every single person, within five questions of Mike, they'll be like, oh, wow, I didn't really think of that one. I've done 5,000 interviews and no one's ever asked me that, you know, kind of thing. And
well,
Joe gets very personal with his questions and then they respond to that with Joe. They're like, wow, that's very, very insightful of you about how you're looking at it, that kind of thing. And Joe always gets that response. So it's just interesting to see the two of them.
So, but yeah, Joe, dueling interviews.
You'd say what?
Yeah, so that's kind of the... But I got to ask Jenny one quick question before you go off on a thing. Jenny, what was your favorite movie when you were a kid growing up? Like, what was one of your favorite films that stands out? Your all-time kid film that you loved, that you watched 100 times or whatever?
Well, aside from the Disney films, I have to say...
Which Disney film, if there was?
Well, The Rescuers. I loved it. Yeah, when I was a kid. That was one of my favorites.
Okay.
I have to say... Oh, God, I had so many films. I love John Hughes. Everything he did, from 16 Candles to Pretty in Pink to Breakfast Club. But I'm also very partial to Gene Kelly films because when I was a child, I watched all of his films with my dad. So Singing in the Rain has to be one of them.
Well, did you know that Gene Kelly directed for a while? He directed films that he wasn't in. He directed a film with Jackie Gleason.
Really?
He directed a film. It was a film called Gigo, where Jackie Gleason plays a mute. Okay. He plays a mute who befriends this woman and her child. Jackie Gleason, it's a serious role, and Jackie Gleason wrote the score, okay? And I think he wrote the screenplay or something, and Gene Kelly directed it.
Wow.
Isn't that kind of fascinating?
I love. He's my childhood hero.
Best performance.
You like Gigo. You remember that movie, right?
Yeah, it's one of his best performances. He's really amazing in it because... He has to, because he can't speak. So, you know, it's that other level of acting. And, I think the review at the time was that they didn't think Gleason could pull it off because no one ever really thought of Gleason as one of those great actors. You know, he was always under the radar. You know?
Yeah, but he did play Minnesota
Fox. Except for The Hustler and stuff.
Yeah, Minnesota.
Yeah, no, except for The Hustler. The Hustler is, you know,
it's brilliant.
But that film, you know... You never saw The Hustler?
I don't think I did, no.
Oh, you've got to see The Hustler.
Okay.
That's prerequisite.
All right, well, before we go too far, so you remember
the agenda.
You remember the premise of listening, like, which is what I just told you. So now, Jenny, you can read your story.
Okay. So it says, team links two human brains for question and answer experiment. And the summary is... researchers used a brain-to-brain interface they developed to allow pairs of participants to play a 20-question style game by transmitting signals from one brain to another over the internet. Over the internet. How interesting. Their experiment is thought to be the first to demonstrate that two brains can be directly linked to allow someone to accurately guess what is on the other person's mind. How is this possible?
Exactly. This is, life is like science fiction. So
through the internet.
What? Well, there's some more details. Go ahead, please.
Okay, so should I read the entire thing?
Yeah, you can read the entire thing.
Imagine a question and answer game played by two people who are not in the same place and not talking to each other. Round after round, one player asks a series of questions and accurately guesses the object the other is thinking about. Sci-fi? Mind-reading superpowers? Not quite. University of Washington researchers recently used a direct brain-to-brain connection to enable pairs of participants to play a question and answer game by transmitting signals from one brain to the other over the internet. The experiment detailed today in Plus One is thought to be the first to show that two brains can be directly linked to allow one person to accurately guess what's on another person's mind. This is the most complex brain-to-brain experiment, I think, that's been done to date in humans. It
It uses conscious experiences through signals that are experienced visually, and it requires two people to collaborate.
Wait. Read that sentence again. It uses conscious
experiences through signals that are experienced visually, and it requires two people to collaborate.
Did you even understand what you just said? Okay.
I'm trying to visualize it.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. The first experiment evolved out of a research by co-author Rajesh Rao, a UW professor of computer science and engineering, on brain-computer interfaces that enable people to activate devices with their minds. In 2011, Rao began collaborating with Stocko and Pratt to determine how to link two human brains together. In 2014, the researchers received $1 million grant from the Keck Foundation that allowed them to broaden their experiments to decode more complex interactions and brain processes.
Now, hold on a second. The what corporation?
The Keck Foundation.
The Keck Foundation. Mm-hmm. Now, that sounds some nefarious.
They received a million dollar grant.
Think about that. What organization will benefit from a brain reading device?
I'm thinking the CIA might be involved.
Yeah, the foundation you never heard of that could just throw out $1 million.
Mm-hmm. They are now exploring the possibility of brain tutoring
via the internet.
Transferring signals directly from healthy brains to ones that are developmentally impaired.
Oh, or, yeah, that's the spin they put on it.
Or impacted by external factors such as a stroke or accident, or simply to transfer knowledge from teacher to pupil. So they're transmitting information from one brain to the other over the internet.
Yes.
This is almost like brainwashing while you're sleeping.
Think about that. If they perfect this technology, who's to say you'll know when they're using it? That's my question. And can they replicate those signals?
Can they manufacture those signals? In the Secret Service?
Well, I don't know. I'm just saying, if they can find out how to actually transmit thoughts, you could go into a store and be like, I must buy that dress.
That is crazy.
All right, so go ahead.
The team is also working on transmitting brain states. For example, sending signals from an alert person to a sleepy one.
Transmitting brain states?
Or from a focused student to one who has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Or, as we know, ADHD.
Well, from a cold fish to a horny... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Imagine having someone with ADHD and a neurotypical student. When the non-ADHD student is paying attention, the ADHD student's brains gets put into a state of greater attention automatically. So what happens to the other one who actually had a greater attention...
Nothing.
And he transmits
it. He's just transmitting.
He's not losing power, is he?
I don't think he's losing
power. Is he transferring power?
But here's my question. What if he gets angry? What if he's got issues? Go ahead.
Anger management situation. I'm writing the script.
Go ahead.
Many technological advancements over the past century, from the telegraph to the internet, were created to facilitate communication between people. The UW team's work takes a different approach, using technology to strip away the need for such intermediaries.
As language.
Evolution has spent a colossal amount of time to find ways for us and other animals to take information out of our brains and communicate it to other animals in the forms of behavior, speech, and so on.
So wait, eventually you could transmit the messages to your dog and your dog could transmit messages to you.
It sounds like it.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, didn't Pavlov? No, Pavlov just used behaviorism. But it requires a translation. We can only communicate part of whatever our brain processes. What we are doing is kind of reversing the process a step at a time by opening up this box and taking signals from the brain and with minimal translation, putting them back in another person's brain. This sounds a little creepy.
Putting them back in another person's brain.
And that's about it.
Tell me that's not, you know, slightly chilling.
It's almost as bad as cloning.
Chris, what's your thoughts there, babe?
Man.
Exactly. What the hell?
Anytime, you know, it's almost like, you know.
Through the internet.
when you plug that interface into your brain, that you know, that whole thing is when it just gets a little weird for me. I mean,
well,
you know,
what's interesting is that movie really is kind of prescient. It's they're already doing this, and he's made a movie about it where they had the people who were able to use these machines in the movie listening. They created like a thought police. So they had to make sure you weren't thinking of, like, betraying or giving away secrets or letting the fact that this is happening. And they were experimenting on making people kill when they wanted them to kill.
Well, the government...
So they had, like, somebody kill their own dog kind of thing.
The government has done this, I'm sure, on many levels.
I want to know who's funding it. What, hold on a sec. Let's stay. Chris, you near your computer?
The Army.
You near your computer?
What was that movie that Leif Schreiber was in? With that was through implanting the chip, though. That was a bit different.
All right.
But
all
so
right,
instead of implanting
well,
chips
I want you to,
now
yeah, I want you to look up what's the name or spell out that corporation, the foundation, the what foundation?
The Keck Foundation.
Spell Keck.
K-E-C-K.
Yes. Look up Keck Foundation. I want to know who that is.
Well, they were just the funders.
Yeah, exactly. Just the funders who just happen to have $1 million to throw at mind control through the internet.
UCF.
It's
USC.
Called the W.M.Keck Foundation.
Well, there's the Keck School of Medicine,
no,
USC.
No. Right. The W, wait, read that again, Jenny.
W.M. Keck Foundation.
W.M. Keck Foundation. Look up W.M. Keck Foundation. And you're tuned to Listen to Sponsored Radio.
They're in California.
Okay.
W.M. Keck Foundation. Grant.
We will send money to Night Shift.
We'll accept.
Let's see. They're quite... You want me to go to the Wikipedia?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I want to know who they are.
All right, well... Okay, let's see. Is an American charitable foundation supporting scientific, engineering, and medical research in the United States. It was founded in 1954 by William Myron
Shatner.
Oh, here we go.
So go
founder
talk.
And president of Superior Oil Company.
Of course.
Exxon Mobil.
Of course. Come on. Think about that.
Let's
diversify. We're running out of oil. Let's get into brain control.
The foundation's trust fund currently has assets in excess of $1 billion.
God. Do I see an eye in a triangle somewhere nearby?
Jumping Jehoshaphat. Well, there it is.
Oh, wait, Mike.
What?
Okay. Let's see. One of some of the things that they've got going on.
Sure,
construction.
Talk to me.
Construction of the W.M. Keck Observatory.
Of course.
In Hawaii. Support for the Keck Observatory at Pacific Lutheran University. So they have another one over there.
And I think it's interesting.
Let's see. They've got an institute in Claremont, California. They've got computer science lab in La Jolla Marymount University in Los Angeles. Pepperdine University, they also have a center there. They have one in Washington, D.C.
None of this is surprising.
You know, it goes, and that's about it. And it says, please do not bother to read anything else.
Exactly. Like,
you know,
now you look them up, you're on a list. So,
oh, wait, this is very interesting.
What?
The Keck Foundation is a long supporter of public television in Southern California, including underwriting the broadcast of Sesame Street.
Smart.
Well, doesn't Sesame Street really brainwash kids?
It could. I mean, that's like, now think about
think
it.
About
a company that owns... Mind control has a stake in Sesame Street.
Mm-hmm.
You do the math.
Mm-hmm.
There we go. You're tuned to Listen Sponsored Radio, WBAI. The name of the show.
Night Shift.
Rock.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, and I'm speaking with writer-director Frank Hall Green, who's got a really terrific new film called Wildlike. Frank, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having us and talking about Wildlike.
When did you first know you wanted to be a storyteller?
I realized I always was sort of daydreaming stories and dreaming stuff up when I also grew up drawing and painting and being just a natural drafts person. And then in high school, I got into photography and sculpture, and then I ended up going to NYU as an undergraduate, not with the intention of going into film, and I ended up being a photography major there, as well as taking some film classes and cinema studies and just furthering my interest in film, not with any intention of going into the career. And then when I graduated, I actually veered away from the arts, and I went into business to start up some venture capital back then for five or six years. I think I sort of was resisting the idea of being an artist because it just seemed like a real slog, you know.
Yeah, I hear you.
But I ended up missing it, and I saw film as a way that I could sort of combine all these things. You know, I could combine business, I could combine visual storytelling and music and photography, and I think I was right.
What is it that you enjoy about actually producing when you're not writing and directing?
Not having the pressure of writing and directing.
I understand.
I think I naturally like organization. I like starting projects, pushing projects forward. I like seeing other people get the projects that they are passionate about, you know, off to a great start. I love being involved in a story. Some stories I love, but I don't want to tell them myself as a director because it's a huge undertaking, but it's a great way to be involved and share and sort of work in a karmic way with other filmmakers. So it's a part of the business I really enjoy. I'm also a bit of a math person, and I do like being involved in the numbers and the budgets and so forth. I was telling somebody else that I wrote a budget for Wildlike before I finished the first draft. I, you know, again, being someone that grew up sort of liking adventure and journeys and stories. I think I wanted to tell a story that was a journey. I had had my mind social issue in the film for quite a while, for years and years and years. Wanted to bring that to light. Thought that there was a way to present it that had not been presented in film and TV, or at least that I hadn't really seen and done. And then I am an outdoors person, a backpacker, and a lover of nature, and I wanted to see that journey be, you know, in the outdoors. As I made stories and wrote stories, they continually came back to the theme of someone going out on a trajectory, typically into the outdoors or out of doors, and how that changes the person or what they encounter. So that story was just inside me.
Alaska kind of becomes a character in the film, and it's such a beautiful and vast landscape that it gives you, the viewer, and the characters you imagine, perspective. Was that one of the reasons you set it there?
Yes. I mean, that was definitely a big part of, I think that's part of that journey, you know, that I wanted to tell, is that the position of setting that you end up in or you put yourself in will have an effect on your person, on your choices, and on your ability to reflect or not reflect. So, you know, I just kept thinking bigger and grander, and Northwest was sort of the first thought. I actually had a thought of trying to do it in the Northeast, of even doing it like in Montauk, and that was quickly swept away, and then I recalled immediately that I had been to Alaska and that it would just be fantastic landscape, and why not, you know, go for that. And the more that we looked at the breadth of Alaska and how that paralleled with, you know, Mackenzie and what the pressure she was under, and then the idea of Alaska being a front, and the fact that, you know, Mackenzie as a young woman, you know, has a sort of frontier of innocence that is lost, and lots of parallels have been coming out.
Was there an aspect of self-discovery in writing this for you?
Yes, definitely, because the story sort of poured out of me and just sort of said, okay, I want to tell this, I want to tell that, and now I see that. I think one of the themes I wanted to hit on is when two people encounter each other in, with a sort of unconditional relationship, with an ability where they don't really have an agenda with each. Young people are allowed to, you know, without a pressure saying, wanting them to do one thing or the other. And then also, we talked about, you know, when people are in nature and how they react to that. And I also wanted to touch on the idea that, you know, there's sort of a triangle to me of Bart and Uncle and Mackenzie, and they all represent different parts of personalities, and some obviously very, very bad, and some obviously very, very, very good. And life is full of good and bad and light and dark, and one thing can lead to another part of the fluctuations. And we did get very lucky with the cast. Everybody was fantastic, got along well, and was great to work with. Ella, I was out here in L.A. looking for her on a casting trip, meeting with agents and young girls, and did not see exactly what I wanted, and went back to the hotel room, turned on the TV, and the movie Never Let Me Go was on. Ella plays a young version of Keira Knightley in the first 20 minutes, and I saw her for just a few minutes, and I knew that she was Mackenzie. Oh, she's so beautiful that it's almost a problem. I was not looking for great beauty. I was looking for just a regular 14-year-old girl, but I wanted someone who was of age, and I wanted someone who could deliver a powerful screen presence and also sort of work in an understated, restrained manner. And she really does do that in Never Let Me Go, and the more I got to know her, the more I believed that she could do it for a while. Like, she came on over a year and a half before we shot the movie. She was first cast. And then Bruce Greenwood came out of a pool of a very various different actors of around the same age range, and he stood out because, you know, also he's worked in independent film and shown some really beautiful natural restrained performances, and in his work with Adam Egoyan, and he's done some work recently with Kelly Reichardt, and he's also underappreciated and extremely talented and just underused. So, you know, as a leading man or as a co-star, he was really able to shine, and I think he took that and ran with it. I mean, it's so very important to me that the look and feel of the film be accurate and be correct, at least in terms of the way I want it to come off. So the first thing I do is I think it's naturally in the script. I think the pacing and the tone and the natural feeling was in, it really was in the script. It was in the dialogue and the way it read. So that was there. Then I had a list of reference films that I think also had that feeling. They weren't necessarily good in terms of story or setting or set place in Alaska or anything like that, but they all had maybe a pace and a restraint and a natural mysticism that I wanted to emulate. And I shared those movies with the actors, and I said, look, this is what we're really going for. I also had a short film that I had done as sort of an exercise leading up to Wildlight, and I set forth saying, okay, I'm going to see if I can make this short film with the same tone that I want Wildlight to have. And it worked. It did. And I shared that movie with them, and they really enjoyed it. So we just kept talking more and more. I think they really got on the same page. Was like, this is what we're doing, and this is neat. And then lastly, when I go into rehearsals and shooting, I tend to like to keep things kind of quiet. You know, obviously, there's a lot of energy, and things are moving fast because you have to. But at the same time, for the performances, you know, I don't yell action or anything like that. I like to let them just go into it. Just start acting, and then when they're done, I let the camera keep rolling to what comes after, and I'll often tell them to do it half the speed that they just did, because I think we all get heat up really easily and excited and moving forward, and so just keep trying to get everything to be more subtle and bam, pull back a little bit. It seems to work.
Well, you know, one of the elements of the film that I enjoyed is, you know, as much as the dialogue tells us things about the characters, I really enjoyed the lack of dialogue. How much the characters says about the characters when they don't respond or don't say anything or just with a look or, you know, even the body language. Was that a big part of your whole process and what you were trying to capture?
Definitely, yeah, it really was. I mean, to be honest, in some way I feel like, you know, if you can't figure out what the right dialogue is, then, you know, maybe you should not saying anything at all, or is there a way to show what you want to tell? And that's something I learned in film school, and, you know, Truffaut has, you know, brought it up of Hitchcock, is he's a master of showing everything. So the more I looked at films that I love, I saw that that was a big part of it. I'm also a big fan of Ingmar Bergman, the director, and he uses a lot of facial landscapes, and, you know, to convey story and feeling, and then that reflected just where they were, you know, in Alaska and what's going on. And And most importantly, the silence of the movie reflects the silence of the issue. I mean, girls that, you know, have been taken advantage of the way that Mackenzie was, they do not talk about it for the most part, and they keep it secret, and that's a big problem that's endemic of the overall issue. So it all sort of gelled together in that way.
Well, now let me ask you this. I tend to believe that a film is actually directed three times. The first time when you're writing it, you're directing in your head. Second time when you're on set, you're getting what you can with the actors. And the third time in editing, you can literally almost create a whole new movie. A, do you agree with that? And B, what is your favorite part, or what do you get out of each stage?
Yes. One, I definitely agree with that. Two, which part do I like the best? That's tricky. Well, writing's the easiest. Right, because you can direct in your mind and everything's perfect. And
right.
It's this really fascinating process where, you know, it's almost like you're starting off like an architect. You're creating this wonderful blueprint, and you're living in your mind. You're seeing these visuals. And even before it goes on the paper, you can just see it and feel it upstairs. And you just know exactly how it needs to look and feel. And then you get down to writing it, and it's once removed from your imagination. It's once removed from your vision at that point. And so it begins at that stage to lose something of what your original vision is. So, yes, being directed and then, you know, goes to another stage of when you find the locations, and they're not exactly what you wrote because that was in your imagination. And you bring the characters and the faces, and yet again, steps removed from what your original intention was. Even if they're very small steps, still moving on. And then when you go into production, you know, you have all these other collaborators come in, and they can't get inside to see the script and hear you and look at your references and storyboards and so forth. So the more and more it goes along, it's less of a, you know, an architect's blueprint. It's more of a, you know, a gardener's vegetable field. And you just, you know, you're starting to hope that it's coming out you wanted, and you really have to let go lots of different areas. And then the editing, although it's still another step, operator and steps removed, it actually does allow you to hear and regel and what the movie actually is, which will be, I think, part of you, but also part of it itself. You know, then it's almost like it's an independent child.
What did you learn about yourself in the making of this film?
Really energetic, overly ambitious. I tend to reach a lot, sometimes more than is wise, and I can easily get discouraged. Things are going, you know, off track according to my script. And so, slowing down, second-guessing myself, allowing others in, you know, being a collaborator, realizing that I'm a student of film, realizing how little control I have over a lot of parts of the process, which I think at the end of the day enables me to be a bit of a perfectionist but not be an asshole, you know, and not be just about it. That has paid off. You know, persistence has been a big thing, too. I don't know that I knew that I had it in me to sort of stay with one project for this many years and stay persistent, because I tend to really like to move from thing to thing, and I think because it's difficult to get scared and give up, it's easy to be excited about something new and be discouraged about something that is, you know, changing and moving away from you.
Now, what's next for you?
Well, I'm doing some producing. I have a production development company with my partner, producer Tom Heller. We're working on some books and things that's not for me to write and direct, but for us to produce. And then from writing, I have a few different scripts I've been working on, and I honestly haven't been able to put my finger on what's next. There's a bit of pressure there to sort of...
What, in your opinion, do you think is the purpose of story? Why do you think we, as human beings, need to tell each other stories?
I think it's innate inside the desire of people to imagine what they want in their life. I think it's what drives us to be alive. And then when you hear stories, you know, it reflects either other people, you know, living those experiences or having, you know, an experience that may be one that you want. And it also reflects the suspense and hope and fear that we have about our own existence. But I really believe that you know, stories are a reflection of what our human nature, you know, what we hope and believe and want and fear, and then the stories, you know, bring that back to us, and that's either reassuring or it's terrifying or it's moving, but it's emotional and it's addictive.
Being so well-rounded, having played and worn so many different hats, do you think that makes you a better filmmaker when you really have a good sense of what everybody's job is?
Yes, absolutely, and I credit some of that to the New York University. They really believe in the author theory and producing filmmakers that have experienced all the jobs and sort of auteurs, are artists, and if they had enough hands and fingers and feet, they could do all the jobs themselves. So I think that's a great way to be, but this telling stories and filmmaking is about having experience to be able to do so and putting yourself in different settings and characters, and I think that also includes the process, putting yourself in different parts of the process and understanding why the sound person is doing what they're doing, the production designer, the editor, and even the producers.
Well, I really enjoyed it, and I hope I get to talk to you again for whatever you do next.
Thanks, me too. Really appreciate it.
All right, thanks, man.
Take care.
You too.
Chris, are you still there?
Yeah.
You're not asleep yet.
Interesting. So tell me, Jenny, what did you think of Wildlike?
Was it Wildlike or Wildfire?
No, Wildlike.
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 Why am I thinking Wildfire?
Because you're a wildfire yourself.
I'm a firecracker.
You're a firecracker.
In the wildfire. you know, I have to say, I was very impressed with it visually.
Weren't you surprised at the film?
I was. The acting was superb. The cinematography was gorgeous. I loved the grading. I loved the coloring. I loved the editing. I loved the way it was shot.
And I talked about this in my interview where the Alaska was like a character in the film.
Yeah, but the images, the angles, you know, the way the director. Obviously, I mean, he's directing and the cinematographer did a fantastic job, but it's very creative. His approach is very creative. It's almost like in a dreamlike state at times. And I'm a huge fan of Bruce Greenwood. So, you know, he's
underutilized
he's
actor.
He's one of my favorites.
He's a great actor.
He is a great, great actor. But I really love the story, too, the story of the film. And it was, you know, had a little bit of Wild in there, had a little bit of Into the Wild in there.
Yes, it was sort of a coming of age Into the Wild.
It was, and not in the way that you would want to come into age.
Right.
But, you know,
and I found that whole sequence with the uncle.
Yes, it was very tastefully done.
Very believable.
And very tastefully shot. It wasn't obscene, and that's what I really loved about it. And I like the way the story ties in together. You know, at the end of the way, it doesn't leave you, it leaves you guessing, but it leaves you happy.
It does, and it talks about, to me, what really stood out to me is it talks about the redemptive power of friendship. You know, how a friendship, you know, especially with an unlikely friendship, it can change you. It can transform you, you know.
Well, you know, we meet everybody in our lives for a reason.
Yes.
And at times
if
we don't.
If you're open for that.
Yes, absolutely. Whether it's a negative or a positive influence, you know, there's
it's
a reason.
To begin, yes.
Exactly. And it was a beautiful friendship. And like you said, she found redemption in that.
Yes. And a redemptive friendship. Especially what I enjoyed, okay, as a male, is, you know, I totally believe, you know, without giving too much away, it's about a young girl who goes to live with her uncle in Alaska. Because her dad died and her mom is having some issues and needs to go to rehab and get her life together. And the uncle, of course, let's just say she's a very pretty girl and he's a youngish, you know, 30-ish, 30-something uncle. And,
pervert.
And he's he's a... he's a pervert.
Sorry, I had to put that in there.
Was that what he's doing?
I'm just saying.
He definitely wasn't thinking with the brain that's on top.
No, but what he was doing, which I thought was very well written, was really doing something to her. He didn't think it was. He thought he was. You know,
he thought he was in love.
He thought it was okay. It was
delusional,
like, right? And what he was really doing was making her feel trapped. And she's young, and what can she do? She's like 14 or 15 years old. So it was very powerful.
A bit of spoiler alert, right there.
Yeah, a little spoiler alert.
Yes,
but that's all I'll say. I didn't say what he does or what's going on. Let's just say he puts her in a situation where it makes her feel she has to flee, and she does. And she flees, and she ends up developing an unlikely friendship with someone who...
She stalks.
Who she kind of stalks.
Sort of.
And he's just a guy who's trying to get his life together from some, you know, issues and his own loss.
His own tragedy.
His own tragedy. And it's very good. It's very well written and very believable.
Yeah.
Their relationship I completely bought. Did you?
Yes. I have to say, you know, she was a little rough around the edges, which is what her character was supposed to be.
And
she did soften up a little bit, but she played a very, you know, believable teen who's going through...
Ella Purnell.
Yes, this crazy period in her life. And
so,
anyway.
So that was the movie, and that was the interview with the director, and I highly recommend it. It just came out this past Friday. It's called Wildlike. Wild like Jenny.
Sometimes.
No.
notice a qualification in there. Sometimes. It's sometimes only with the good-looking stupid guy.
No, only when necessary or when I want to be.
Okay, so, Jenny,
yes,
you have another story for us, but I do want to talk about a couple movies since we're talking about movies here. Two movies that have just come out on DVD. Mm-hmm. One is Entourage, the movie.
Yes.
And one is Magic Mike XXL.
Ooh, yeah.
Now, they're both movies with boys.
Double XL.
I would like to know. First, I want your thoughts
Don't
on
say no to that.
Entourage, the movie. And were you a fan of the show? And Chris, were you a fan of the show, Entourage, the show?
I watched it like
intermittent,
I don't know, first five episodes, six episodes, and then it seemed like it jumped the shark to me, and that was it.
So you didn't make it past the first season?
Yeah, not really. I thought it was an interesting idea, and then, you know, he started to annoy me. What's his face?
Which one? Adrian Grenier?
No, the guy that used to be friends with John Cusack.
Avi.
Ari Gold?
Ari Gold, yeah. Jeremy That's his Piven? Character's name. That's
Jeremy
his name.
Piven?
Jeremy Piven, yeah.
Kevin Dillon?
No, Jeremy
Piven. Jeremy.
Did you just say Avi?
I said Avi. I thought his name was Avi. It was Ari.
But I thought the idea when it first came out, it was kind of interesting.
Avi comes
and then
to mind. I know.
I just thought it's...
The uncool Avi. Yeah. No, so you like... All right, now, what about you? Were you a fan of the show, Jenny?
Definitely. I admit I was hooked on Entourage.
Really?
I love the concept. I thought they were absolutely hilarious.
Okay.
And of course the character of Ari Gold. He's he makes the show.
Yeah, well,
he and Kevin Dillon,
very believable.
They're
yeah.
both hilarious. And the script was brilliant, and you know,
now, what did you think of
the
movie?
Concept.
What did you think of the movie as compared to the show?
Well, the movie.
Now, were you excited? Give me a little build-up.
I was. I'm sorry. You know, I admit I went in there all giggly and, you know, popcorn
well,
in
yeah,
hand.
Well, you know, you love these characters.
Excited
love,
to see these characters, you know, come to life again. And, you know, I have to say, I enjoyed it. It was a guilty pleasure. And it was just a longer version, a very long version of an episode.
Well, you know, I have to say, I had so many friends tell me, you know, Entourage, you gotta watch it, you gotta check out this character Turtle, oh my god, Entourage. And having had my own entourage, okay, when I was in my early 20s, you know, and being the leader of the group.
Of the pack. The wolf pack.
I had my own little wolf pack, and we were, you know, we were Hollywood bound, okay? So I was like, all right.
Hollywood howlers.
I buy into the concept. So I watched about a season, and I get it. I got it. Because they had been sending it to me. I was up to like third season at that point. The show was still on. And I watched the first season. Maybe it had just ended right around the time I started to watch. I watched the first season. I was into it, you know. But again, as you know in this business, who has time to watch
everything.
What you want to watch
right.
versus what you have to watch? So when I saw the episode, when I saw the movie, I felt like it was a halfway decent episode. I didn't feel it was worthy of a movie. I felt it was just like a decent episode, not even a great episode, and probably not even the best episode of the show, was it?
Well, because you know what? They put it all into one
I mean, they
film,
wrapped up a lot
know,
of
two,
stuff.
In a two-hour film. And Haley Joel Osment was really great.
He was really great.
And they brought in a lot of big names, a lot of cameos, a lot of celebrities. And
but that's,
there was a lot of
that's
eye
part
candy.
Of the show. That's
a
part
lot
of the show.
TNA. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, listen, it was entertaining. And that's
okay.
what the movie is set out to be, entertaining.
Well, it's what the Chris called the shark jumping. The shark jumping is part of the show, to have celebrities play themselves and
right.
then do these things. And so, I mean,
I felt the same way, Mike. You know, I liked the first, I liked it. You know, maybe I saw six episodes. And then I, you know, we had our own entourage, Mike. I mean, we were living that.
Yeah, well,
was Chris part of your entourage?
Chris, meeting Chris for me was, I was someone who had an entourage. And when I met Chris, he had his own entourage. And it was like, hey, you know, it was like.
Did you guys combine entourages?
Clash of the Titans.
Did you drop a few members?
Well, no, he kind of hung with my entourage a bit, and I got to hang with his entourage a bit, so we kind of...
Yeah, so you didn't combine.
We can interact with our entourages, with their, and, various entourages. And it was great, because, Mike's entourage was always a lot of fun, you know, and the thing that was funny about Mike's entourage is, you know, Mike made the decisions.
Funny about that.
Now, how long ago? How long were we talking about?
Many moons ago.
But Jenny, what was great was that you could always trust Mike's decisions. Like Mike always,
like
had
any good leader.
Mike always had the complete back of all in his entourage. So,
like, what's the point of having an entourage if they don't have your back? I mean, it's not an entourage.
No, but I mean, like, it's like you don't have to think. He just does all the thinking for you. You don't have to worry about nothing. He's got all the bases covered at all times.
Right.
He is amazing.
You don't need eyes in the back of your head with him.
That's right. You don't need.
He is amazing. You could travel. Mike could just do, like, you know, he could travel the world. You could travel the world with Mike. You want to meet the Pope? Come with Mike.
Travel the world with Mike.
So you're saying that he...
I have a show on the
Travel Channel. He has connections. He can pull strings.
Well,
he can just pull it all together. He is the master of...
He is Magic Mike.
Yeah.
There it is. That's a good segue there, Jenny.
Yeah.
God, I am just the woman of puns tonight.
You're the woman of puns. So now let me ask you this. All right, so entourage. So you give it a thumbs up. Now, what about Matt? Now, first of all, what do you think of the first Magic Mike?
You know, I didn't know what to think going in.
He's like the world's greatest voyeur.
I went in there thinking, okay, this is going to be a completely cheesy film.
Oh, come on. You were excited.
I swear
don't
to
lie.
You. No.
Don't
no,
lie.
No.
You're lying like
I've
Chris now.
I've never been a fan of
Naked
a strip
Man.
Joint.
I've never been a fan
no,
of Naked
I,
Man.
No, I mean that.
I think
I
it's
mean
wrong.
That. I swear.
Yeah, please. But then why are you turning red?
Because I walked out of the theater.
Yeah, whatever.
Know, with a little perspiration on my forehead.
I see.
I was pleasantly surprised. Let's leave it at that.
I'll be honest with you. I expected Magic Mike. I had no expectations of Magic Mike.
Matthew McConaughey impressed me
I
in that film.
Magic Mike
in
was
the first
a very good
one.
Film.
And, you know, Channing Tatum is he? You know, he's really proven himself. He's a really
talented.
Great actor.
He's really funny, too.
He's a great dancer.
Yeah, he's an amazing dancer.
He really is a great
he's
dancer.
He's funny. He's a good action hero. He's just, you know, he's clearly got a charmed life. Now, Magic Mike. XXL.
Again, guilty pleasure.
So, how does it compare to the first one? What's your review?
You know, again, entertaining, a lot of eye candy. I enjoyed it.
I see.
It's pure guilty pleasure. It's entertaining.
We lost Chris somehow.
And that was Mike's reply.
Yeah, that was my reply.
To my entertainment.
So, okay. All right. So you were entertained?
Yes. A lot of gyrating bodies, a lot of hot abs. I mean...
Why are you fanning yourself right now while you're giving the review?
I have to.
Yes, I see.
Why are you fanning yourself, Jenny?
Of
Michael... what's his...
She can't even remember his last name. Look at, oh, what are those men? Whatever their names were.
Sofia Coppola's future husband.
I see. Is that who... Is he dating Sofia?
Yes, the big guy. Oh God, I forget his name.
Does it matter?
It'll come to me in a second.
Do you really need names?
No,
I see exactly.
Joe Manganiello.
Yeah, Joe Manganiello.
He's the one who's he's the big guy.
You're with him. You're with it.
Well, I approve.
You approve
of Sophia's choice.
You approve of Sophia's choice. Okay. I understand. All right, so both of those films, you'd say get them on Blu-ray, DVD, get them?
Yeah, why not? It's nice for a rainy day.
There's a joke in there, but I'm not going to make it. All right, so you can go to your next story then, completely getting off the movie track here for a minute.
Which one would you like me to read?
What's the one in front of you there? What's the first one?
Can your sense of smell predict when you'll die?
Yes,
come on. A correlation between declining ability to smell and lifespan in worms has been uncovered by researchers. If the signaling between neurons ends up being important in how other organisms, including humans, age,
the manipulating the nervous system may prove a fruitful way to minimize the effects of aging or rejuvenate brain functions, one author says. So could a declining sense of smell predict when one will die? Isn't that interesting, Mike?
It's more than interesting. I want to know how this works. Talk to me.
By measuring how worms move toward an appealing food-like scent, researchers at the Salk Institute were able to predict whether the worms would be long-lived.
An appealing food-like scent.
Yes. The finding, publishing September 22, 2015 in the journal eLife, shows how nematodes process information.
Nematodes are the worms?
I'm guessing. There's a very long scientific name after that, which I cannot read. Process That's information okay. about the environment and how circuits in the brain change as an animal ages. Mm. We're not saying that your ability to smell is going to make you live longer, but this odor behavior is likely indicative of some kind of underlying physiology.
Indicative. And, you know, that makes something interesting because women generally live longer than men, and women generally have a stronger sense of smell than men.
Well, I know I have a very keen sense of smell.
Yes, most women do.
I do.
And as a matter of fact, the women who aren't born with it, you know that women who become pregnant get an increased sense of smell.
Yes.
That's clearly something.
Is this why we live longer?
Over. Well, that's what's it. Finish the article because that's where I'm going with this. And it's interesting that the sense of smell is linked in some way to longevity. Women smell better than men. They live longer. What's happening?
The small C. elegans has 12 pairs of specialized neurons in its brain that detect stimuli in the environment. Scientists had previously identified individual
just
pairs.
Just so you know, I'm very good at detecting stimuli in the environment.
Scientists had previously identified individual pairs of these neurons as required for the animals to respond to attractive odors. Chalasani and his colleagues wanted to understand this entire process in more detail. In their work, the researchers measured the responses of all 24 neurons as C. elegans was exposed to benzaldehyde, a chemical that gives off a pleasant, almond-like smell. Surprisingly, rather than the individual pairs that had been previously shown, they found that additional neurons were also involved. Interestingly, these cells were divided into primary and secondary neurons. Primary neurons showed activity in response to the benzaldehyde, while secondary neurons responded to signals sent by the primary neurons. By having a neural circuit structured like this, the team hypothesizes, the worm can get better information on the strength or concentration of a smell. If you have multiple different cells that are all detecting a stimulus, you can use the combination of them to get more dynamic information. Using this strategy allows an animal to generate flexible behavioral responses to its environment. For instance, some behaviors could only be triggered when a smell is strong enough to cause activity in particular combinations of neurons. The researchers speculate that other species with larger brains may use similarly structured neural circuits to represent sensory information and fine-tune their behaviors. Since they knew that worms, like other animals and people, often begin to lose their sense of smell with age, Chalasani and Leenwand next measured how the circuit composed of primary and secondary neurons changes as C. elegans gets older. While the primary neurons don't show a decline in activity, they found secondary neurons become less active with age. This suggests that communication between neurons could be degraded as animal ages. A phenomenon which might also hold true in other neural circuits in many different species. God, this is scientific.
It is scientific, but it was still somewhat.
The scientists went on to show a correlation between poor performance on a smell-based test, moving toward a point source of benzaldehyde, the activity of secondary neurons, and the animal's lifespan. Older animals that were more successful in finding the odor lived about 16% longer than animals that were less good at moving toward the smell.
Interesting.
Even though all these animals are siblings and have similar genomes, if you look at neuron activity, behavioral performance, or lifespan, there are significant differences. Perhaps that's because some animals have better signaling between primary and secondary cells. There are a lot of questions that remain about what exactly is changing as an animal ages. We want to keep looking at what is changing to cause some animals to have better functioning nervous systems and to live longer. So it's not really completely answering the question,
but it does bring up, it's interesting. It's an interesting discovery and hypothesis.
Keep your senses strong.
Chris, did you come back? Are you back?
I'm back. I just wish they could identify what the smell is so we know. Smells like hamburgers. We're going to die.
No, that means you're going to live longer.
If you can still smell the hamburgers, then you're going to live.
You know, identify the smell, and then, you know, what's the smell of death? You know, if you smell like, you know,
what's the smell of death?
Oh, God, I'll tell you what the smell of death is.
You know what the smell of death is?
Well, there are things I've smelled that smell like death.
Mm. At the Mexican restaurant bathroom. All right, I understand. Well, you're tuned to Listener Sponsored Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM. The name of the show?
Night Shift.
So you have another story for us. Chris, are you still there?
Yeah.
I'm just not sure.
Are you having some coffee, Chris?
No. I had a question. I was trying to figure out if it was Breakfast Club or Weird Science. Which one was it for you?
Definitely Breakfast Club. Although I did like Weird Science as well. But Breakfast Club.
Come on, every girl loves Breakfast. What about
Molly,
16 Candles?
Molly Ringwald was my girl.
What about 16 Candles?
She was your girl, huh?
She was my girl. She was the one, you know, we all wanted to be.
I just watched Breakfast Club the other day. It's interesting. It still holds up.
Yeah. They're classic. I mean, John Hughes was brilliant.
John Hughes, what a tragedy that he...
I know.
The way he died was just so...
It was tragic, and he was such... I mean...
And he hadn't done anything for so long, and it's just like he's walking through Central Park and he just dies. I was just like, wow. I was really blown.
You know, one of my other favorites is Uncle Buck because it's just so out.
My favorite John Hughes film. I can't really, you know, say anything, but Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
That was great too.
Oh, I love that
was
movie.
So good.
I can watch
you know,
a movie anytime.
Another tragic death, John Candy.
Oh yeah, John Candy.
Oh yeah,
I love John Candy, but I have to say, Trains, Trains, and Automobiles.
That was
that movie
hilarious.
Is like, I just love that movie. Hilarious. It's just I can watch it. If you put it on right now, I'd watch it.
I would watch any John Hughes movie over and over and over again.
Any John Hughes movie.
I would.
What the one with the baby that's the, it's like a takeoff on the Popeye baby.
Which one are we talking about?
Who's talking?
Popeye baby? Which Popeye
no,
baby?
No, you remember Popeye baby. No, not Luke Who's Talking. That's not John Hughes.
No, that was John Travolta.
That's John Travolta. And that's Susan, what's your name? But no. John Hughes, he did the one. You remember in Popeye, there was always Popeye and Olive Oil's baby was always like crawling around and almost getting killed.
Okay, I didn't see that one.
No, I'm just saying. But you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
You remember in the Popeye cartoon?
Yeah.
And he'd always, like, he'd be on the construction site and he'd just be crawling after something.
Yes, and he never got hurt.
He never got hurt, right. Well, John Hughes did a live-action movie like that. It was directed by Howard Deutsch. I never saw it.
I didn't see that one.
Well, there it is.
Oh, you know, Furious Bueller's Day Off. Forgot about that.
Oh, yes. God, another classic.
That's John Hughes,
that
too?
Was another
wow.
classic.
That was John
right.
Hughes.
Wow.
That was. I mean, everything he touched turned to gold.
He was pretty much the man throughout the 80s.
He was. And they transcend time. His films...
With Curly Sue. Curly Sue, Mike? Is that the
no,
one?
No, it's not Curly Sue. Curly Sue's with the
that
girl.
That was cute, too.
I never saw that.
He stopped. That was the last film he directed in 1991.
No, he didn't direct it. He wrote it and produced it.
He wrote it.
Wrote it and
what
produced
year?
It. I don't know.
She's when having it... a baby.
No,
see.
That's not him.
I'm trying to. Somebody's a writer. I'm trying to find what film you like that he was.
No, I didn't
baby.
Say I liked it. I just thought it was stupid. That's all I'm saying. Well, it's 2:07 in the morning, and you're tuned to you're tuned to listen to sponsored radio WBAI 99.5.
You're tuned to Nostradamus, the future.
WBAI 99.5 FM, and in New York, and on the web at 99.5 on the web at WBAI.org. And this is Night Shift. If you are enjoying the show, you can like us on Facebook.
Like us.
Love N-I-T-E.
Us.
We don't have a love button, but there's a like button. N-I-T-E-S-H-I-F-T. It's on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter. We have all kinds of life. It's like science fiction stories going out. It's at N-I-T-E-S-H-I-F-T-Z. Night Shift. And or you can visit us on the web and you can listen to shows going back for 10 years at lifeislikesciencefiction.com. All right, Jenny, you have that weird story there. You tell
me. I do have a weird story, and I'm just realizing it's coming out of the UK, so it has to be weird.
It's coming out of the UK, and that's slightly repressed.
They breed weird.
Yeah, they do. Go ahead.
They epitomize weird. Startling survey reveals more than a quarter of men would like to wear heels to work. Why is it's beyond me?
I'm not in that percentile.
According to experts, a good number of blokes are envious of their female colleagues' confidence-boosting wardrobes. More than a quarter of men would like to wear heels to work to make them feel more confident, it has been revealed. Do they realize what kind of back pain they're going to suffer?
But I got to say, I don't feel confident wearing heels.
Foot pain. Anyway, research found 32% of men in the Northwest admitted to being envious of their female colleagues' wardrobes.
Now, let me just say this. I am envious of how much a woman can do to change her look. You know, I can do a few things. I can wear a hat.
But men have great fashion, too. Granted, they don't pile on the makeup like a lot of women do.
Pile on makeup, but a woman can do all kinds. She can change the color of her hair.
Men do it as well.
Yes, in the extreme. You can.
Yes.
Yeah, but how many men change the color of their hair? That's pretty rare.
I've seen it. I've seen
it. Of course you have.
Quite a bit.
Yeah, you have, like, in certain crowds, yes. But the average guy, he does not change the color of his hair, just so you know.
He just doesn't want to.
He may want to, but he doesn't.
But if he does, he would.
It's not accepted. You can't like show up a blonde the next day and everybody go, "Oh, you look great, Bill."
Why, they advertise it for men all the time.
Yeah, it's a certain kind of man, yes, will. A, how many heterosexual men go around dyeing their hair?
A lot and of people bleach blonde. There was a time when
a lot of people?
A lot of guys were dyeing their hair bleach blonde at
one
time.
In the 80s?
No, I want to say 90s.
You think so?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe so. And let the
even in the 2000s.
Grow. In the dark roots grow.
Yeah.
Well, that's because they wanted to. All right, finish that article.
Anyway.
Yeah, they wanted it.
Furthermore, it also unveiled over half of men believe it is unfair women can wear a skirt while it is deemed socially unacceptable for men.
Now, I don't feel I need to wear a skirt.
I don't get it.
Why, do you like a man in a skirt?
I mean, not unless there's a kilt ritual happening and they're Scottish. I just don't see it. I like a man in nice pants or shorts.
Well, Chris wears a skirt at home. Chris, what kind of skirt do you wear?
Don't listen, you know.
To each his own.
No, the whole heel thing. By the way, it was Baby's Day Out, Mike.
Baby's Day Out, exactly. That's the movie.
It's crazy. But
you never saw Baby's Day Out? John Hughes? Jenny?
I'm sorry?
You never saw Baby's Day Out?
No.
Okay.
Oh, that was the movie.
That's the movie.
No, yeah, I never saw that.
That
is
totally
that
Popeye
sorry,
baby.
I was still focused on this article. It blows my mind that men want to wear heels.
Yeah, finish the article. It's almost done.
Yeah, I don't want to wear no heels. I don't even like the idea. Wearing platform shoes from Kiss looks like the extent.
Well, I get why certain men would like to wear a bit of a platform shoe to give them a lift. But a heel on a man, first of all, do these men even understand the kind of torture we have to, we have to put up with?
And what's up with the women getting operations from the time they're like 19, 20, these operations they have to get, have something removed so they can wear heels all the time?
Really?
Yes. Do you know about this?
No.
This is ridiculous.
Come on.
I swear to you. It's a common operation.
All I know is that women that wear heels every day, especially in New York City, suffer extreme back pain as they get older. Your body isn't aligned. And for men to want this, well, you know.
I don't think they're thinking that. They think they're just looking for, like, you know. Go ahead.
Wine company Barefoot Wine compiled the findings to encourage men in the area to be brave and express their inner selves through their clothes, as well as increasing work productivity. It was also discovered almost a third of men and women would rather go barefoot wearing no shoes to work. Now, that I get.
That's a Flintstone thing.
That's like working on the beach. More than 80% would like to wear whatever they want for one day a week. I get that as well.
Casual Fridays.
Exactly. Surprisingly, many men said they would consider wearing heels to work as it would make them feel more confident in the workplace.
Well, help me out there.
Come
Chris,
on.
Chris, do you feel more confident with heels?
No, none of it makes any sense. I mean,
It would accentuate their glutes.
Let me ask you.
It would accentuate their calves.
As a woman, do you feel more confident in heels?
No, I do. I do feel sexier in heels. I'm just thinking,
some men got some big ass feet, like 12.
Yeah, who wants to see size 12 in heels?
Those are tranny shoes. Those are tranny shoes. Yep.
Is that a website? Trannyshoes.com.
Cross-dressing tranny shoes.
Tranny shoes. There it is. That's who I want to hang out with. I want to hang out with tranny shoes.
Listen, trannyshoes.com.
That's a good name for a band. Listen. Tranny shoes is playing tonight.
You dig into RuPaul's closet and she's
I'm
got
I'm telling you, we're in a different world. Trannyshoes.com. Shoes for men who want to wear heels.
Oh,
I'm
Mike's
with it.
Got some trannyshoes.com. Hiding them.
What's that?
Man.
I said that's where you found the 10-inch heels.
Exact 10-inch heels. That's insane.
Well,
you're gonna hurt yourself.
And you know what? The men could have see-through tranny shoes.
No, that I want tranny shoes awesome. With goldfish in the heel.
Only if that's going to be accompanied by a performance, Mike.
See all the knots.
Magic Mike.
Exactly. Magic Mike.
Mike.
Okay. So, that I thought was an interesting story. And I have a couple more for you, Jenny. You have another one slightly science-y.
There, I do. I think. Yeah. I have a lot of science-y.
Yeah, but science-y is good because this life is like science fiction. Chris?
With the W.H. Keck Foundation, there was two more things that I wanted to...
What do you want to say?
On the W.M. Keck Foundation, their requirements are that the research is high impact and questions or challenges the prevailing paradigm.
I don't understand what you just said.
That's what it says here. It says here the foundation's requirements for funding is that they will fund you if your research is high impact and that questions or challenges the prevailing paradigm.
Okay.
I don't know what that means. That's
well, that means like you challenge what people are consciously believe. They want you to show that, it's like time travel, mind control, beaming up. People don't believe it's possible. But
so they're like the Haddon Foundation in Contact.
Yes.
They also say here, research projects that are not funded by any other foundation is part of their, or they could not get, or they could not move along without funding from the Keck Foundation. So it just sounds like Haddon from Contact.
Right? Well, there it is. All right, so what do you got there, Jenny?
Oh, Mike, these stories that come out of the UK, they are priceless. It's priceless. So this one is about a death cafe. Death cafes are coming to Britain, but they are not for everyone.
That's a good name for a band.
Death Cafe.
Death Cafe.
It is. The unusual venues are for those who want to speak about passing on, and a crowdfunding initiative hopes to open one in London. The concept of a cafe where people can get together and speak about death might not be for everyone, you think? But one man is hoping there's death interest cafe. In opening one permanently in London. Like, as if people aren't depressed enough there.
Death Cafe. I'll meet you down at the Death Cafe.
John Underwood is a resident of the capital who is launching an online crowdfunding project for the new venture. The 32-year-old married dad of two is no stranger to projects on death, as he is a funeral advisor. Of course he is.
A funeral advisor.
Simply now, put...
Do you have a card for that? Funeral advisor.
Simply put, deathcafe.com says, at a death cafe, people often, strangers... gather to eat cake, drink tea, and discuss death. I wonder.
I like to eat cake and discuss death.
Now, does the coffee taste like death?
Exactly.
Our objective is to increase awareness of death with a view to helping people make the most of their finite lives.
How can you not be aware of death? Increase awareness of death.
Isn't that why people have become religious?
Like you come in,
you're going to die. All right, how are you doing?
It's like increase. Do you need to increase your awareness of death?
No.
Yes, you do.
I'm well aware of that.
Exactly. Who's not aware? Go ahead, Jenny.
This is crazy.
Every day I start to look at, like, what's the day? When does it all
Listen,
end?
You need to be more increasingly aware of death. Go ahead.
A death cafe is a group-directed discussion of death with no agenda, objectives, or themes.
Death
well, that's good.
With no agenda.
They're not promoting it. It's a discussion group rather than a grief support or counseling session and is
Or a suicide club.
Exactly. It is Suicide Month. And is always offered on
Is this Suicide Month?
It is.
What does that mean?
Well, that means suicide prevention.
Suicide Month. I was born in Suicide Month.
We're not condoning it. We're trying to prevent it.
Damn. Why is September got to be Suicide Month? What the hell? Can we lobby? Exactly. That's what I want to know. Somebody obviously not born in September.
Happy birthday and die.
Happy birthday and don't commit suicide. Go ahead.
According to the Evening Standard, there have been so far 2,000 death cafes held across 30 countries. Well, that's lovely. John explains the time is right to offer a place where people can come to engage with death. More and more people are expressing support and getting involved. This is very creepy. It's almost pushing people to want to die.
Who is it that wrote Clockwork Orange? It's like something he would write.
Death Cafe London is committed to enabling all people, especially individuals with marginalized identities, to safely use and shape the venture. Shares in the community venture will be priced at £50 each when they go on sale on October 19th.
What does it mean to have a marginalized identity?
I have no idea.
But I want to understand that phrase. Chris, can you look
up
marginalized identity?
So what they're saying is that they're not really sure of their own identity.
Is that what it is?
What marginalized identity would be.
You're not sure, or just nobody's acknowledging it? Like, I am somebody. No, you're not. Like, Chris, can you look up marginalized identity for me? I want to know
what that means.
I don't know what it is. Marginalized identity. That's a good name for a band. That's a good name for a band, though. I like it. Kind of like a punk band.
Including
Death
Cafe. I don't
think anybody would get it. They spent most of the time trying to figure it out.
Well, that's just it. Marginalized identity.
Marginalized identity. Definition. Let us see what that is. We're temporarily having problems searching for your information. All right, let's see here. Hang on. Marginal.
I think it's a partial identity. That's what I'd like
a
to say.
Partial identity.
Yeah, you're not quite sure. Identity crisis.
Marginalized, though, that sounds like marginalized suggests that there's somebody creating that margin that you're not reaching.
It's all a bunch of bollocks to me.
Well,
it is,
marginalized by who? By the, you know, by the who? By the dominant culture?
By the cult, Death Cafe.
Did you find anything on marginalized identity?
It's kind of weird here, the way they've got it broken down. Just because it goes to identity is how a person appears both to themselves and to others. I'm trying to see where they then put marginal. It just says it.
Thank you. you find anything?
Silent. I think he's gone to sleep.
I think he's gone to sleep.
Thinking about Death Cafe.
Death Cafe. You have a marginalized identity. All right. So, I'm just going to read this headline here. Okay. Antidepressants plus blood thinners cause brain cancer cells to eat themselves in mice.
What?
That's right. I'll read that again. Antidepressants plus blood thinners cause brain cancer cells to eat themselves in mice.
Is that a good thing?
You know, it
that means
here,
if they're eating themselves or killing themselves off.
Well, yeah, it is supposedly.
So it's time.
It's a good thing
to invest.
So antidepressants and blood thinners. Okay, and here's a summary. Antidepressants work against brain cancer by excessively increasing tumor autophagy. Autophagy. That's a process that causes the cancer cells to eat themselves. New research shows the scientists next combine the antidepressants with blood thinners, also known to increase autophagy, as a treatment for mice with the first stages of human something I can't pronounce. Mouse lifespan doubled with the drug combination therapy, while either drug alone had no effect.
So it's time to pair the two.
There it is. You pair the two, and it actually causes brain cancer cells to eat themselves.
Does it recommend a dosage?
You know, it's in mice, so I think that they really can't. This is some Swiss researchers who are doing this there. They found that the antidepressants work against brain cancers by excessively increasing this tumor autophagy in a process that's the one that cancers. The scientists next combined antidepressants with blood thinners, also known as to increase the autophagy, as a treatment in mice, and it said the mice lifespan doubled with the drug combination therapy, while either drug alone had no effect.
Interesting.
That is interesting.
Interesting.
So, it means that things we don't understand about the human brain. Now, here's another one that's interesting. Man walks again after years of paralysis.
What?
Yes. Says the ability to walk has been restored following a spinal cord injury using one's own brain power, according to research. Okay. The preliminary proof of concept study shows that it is possible to use direct brain control to get a person's legs to work again.
So is this something new that they're going to?
This is great. Right here, this is
Do you think Stephen Hawking can benefit from this?
I'm sure there are a lot of people can. It says here the ability to walk has been restored following a spinal cord injury using one's own brain power, according to the research published in Open Access Journal of Neuroengineering and Rehabilitation. The preliminary proof of concept study shows that it is possible to use direct brain control to get a person's legs to walk again.
That's brilliant.
It's amazing,
If this is, in fact, true,
this is
a brilliant
from Silence,
breakthrough.
Silence Science Daily. It says, this is the first time that a person with complete paralysis in both legs, that's a paraplegia, they call it, due to a spinal cord injury, was able to walk without relying on manually controlled robotic limbs, as with previous walking aid devices. The participant, who had been paralyzed for 5 years... Chris, somehow he disappeared. The participant, who had been paralyzed for 5 years, walked along. Where is it? Okay, walked along. I don't know where that was. It says the participant, who had been paralyzed for 5 years, walked along a 3.66 meter long course using an electrocephalogram. That's EEG.
Chris got so excited by the news that he went to go share it with the world.
Yes, he did. The system takes electrical signals from the participant's brain, which then travel down to electrodes placed around his knees to create movement.
That's incredible. Why haven't they discovered this? All these years.
This is all new. It says here, Dr. Ann Doe, one of the lead researchers involved in the study from the University of California, Irvine, USA, says even after years of paralysis, the brain can still generate robust brain waves that can be harnessed to enable walking.
Wow.
We showed you that you can restore intuitive brain-controlled walking after a complete spinal cord injury. This non-invasive system for leg muscle stimulation is a promising method and an advance of our current brain-controlled systems that use virtual reality or a robotic exoskeleton. It says mental training was initially needed to reactivate the brain's walking ability. It says, and seated and wearing an EEG cap to read his brain waves, the participant trained to control the avatar in a virtual reality environment. He also required physical training to recondition and strengthen the leg muscles. The participant later practiced walking while suspended 5 centimeters above ground so he could freely move his legs without having to support himself.
That means that the person has to restart.
Yes,
with the muscle.
Right, they have to get the muscle going. They have to learn how to do it.
Muscle strengthening.
On his 20th visit, he translated these skills to walk on the ground and wore a body weight support system for aid and to prevent falls. Over the 19-week testing period, he gained more control and performed more tests per visit.
Wow.
The proof of concept study involved a single patient, so further studies are needed to establish whether these results are true for a larger population of individuals with paraplegia.
That's incredible.
That is pretty incredible. That's pretty amazing.
It makes me think, I wish Christopher Reeves was around to benefit from this.
Yeah, Christopher Reeves, yeah. He would have been the guy. He would have been the guy to help fund. Honestly, he'd have been the face of that.
And, you know, perhaps, hopefully, he would have benefited from this. I mean,
sure, if we could see Christopher, like they used to have these commercials, you know, Christopher Reeve will walk again, and then you'd see him walking. Chris, are you there? Are you back?
Yeah, no, I'm here. Everything's okay.
We thought you just got so excited by this news that you went to share it with the world.
No, I became, that was the definition of marginal identity, just disappearing.
Yes, your identity was marginalized, briefly.
It was just,
has it been restored?
I can't find anything that combines those words, Mike. It's either
marginalized identity. Marginal. You can't find
that. No, that's not. Okay. That's okay. That's a good thing.
That's a good thing.
That's a good thing. Let's leave it be. That means that we're in a different place than the English.
J-pop there. All right, so you have another story.
I do. I'm going to choose this story, though, although I have a few here, because I think this is very current. Energy drinks linked to traumatic brain injury in teens.
What?
Uh-huh. Because our society is so obsessed with energy drinks, obviously, like Red Bull. And Lord knows, everybody drinks them, especially people in production.
Do you drink them?
I used to.
Do you drink them,
I
Kenny?
Used to. I
you
used to. I, not anymore. I prefer coffee.
Read the headline again.
Energy drink comes. Oh, the heading was energy drinks linked to traumatic brain injury in teens. Energy drink consumption could interfere with recovery efforts.
Mm.
Teens who reported a traumatic brain injury in the past year were 7 times more likely to have consumed at least 5 energy drinks in the past week than those without a history of TBI. Researchers found that teens who reported sustaining a TBI within the past year were at least twice as likely to have consumed energy drinks mixed with alcohol than teens who reported sustaining a TBI more than a year previously. You know, that's a big thing. Red Bull and vodka, Red Bull and tequila.
Listen, there was a drink that they outlawed in New York. I tried it once, called Sparks.
Hmm.
It was caffeine-laced malt liquor, flavored malt liquor.
Interesting.
It was nasty. But, you know, I tried it.
Teens who reported a traumatic brain injury in the past year were 7 times more likely to have consumed at least 5 energy drinks in the past week than those without a history of TBI.
Really? So if you have brain injury, you want to have... Okay.
Well, you know, what they're saying is that those who had traumatic brain injury had definitely consumed at least 5 energy drinks. Researchers also found that teens who reported sustaining a TBI within the past year were at least twice as likely to have consumed energy drinks. Why is this repeating itself on me?
That's interesting.
We found a link between increased brain injuries and the consumption of energy drinks or energy drinks mixed with alcohol. This is significant because energy drinks have previously been associated with general injuries, but not specifically with TBI. Energy drink consumption could interfere with recovery efforts for teens who have sustained a TBI. Energy drinks such as Red Bull and Rockstar contain high levels of caffeine and change the chemical state of the body, which can prevent people from getting back on track after TBI. Mm. Brain injuries among adolescents are particularly concerning because their brains are still developing. Mm. At a time when energy drink consumption is rising among teens in Canada and the U.S., the study also suggests that the caffeinated drinks are particularly linked with those who play sports. Yes. Oh, especially because Red Bull promotes, you know, these crazy sports and adrenaline-driven sports. Yeah. I think that energy drinks appeal to teens, especially athletes, because the drinks provide temporary benefits such as increased alertness, improved mood, enhanced mental and physical states, said Dr. Cusimano. Advertisements for the drinks are also often feature prominent athletes. Well, this is not a good thing, is it?
It's kind of disturbing in a way.
It is. It is particularly concerning to see that teens who report a recent TBI are also twice as likely to report consuming energy drinks mixed with alcohol. While we cannot say this link is causal, it's a behavior that could cause further injury, and so we should be looking at this relationship closely in future research. Previous research at St. Michael's Hospital found that TBI is associated with poor academic performance, mental health issues, violence, substance abuse,
and violence.
Yes, well, I could see that because your adrenaline is you know,
sure,
is boosted, and aggression in both teens and adults. Factors that can interfere with rehabilitation. According to the new study, a better understanding of the link between TBI and energy drinks could help medical professionals, parents, teachers, and coaches understand how to better prevent, diagnose, and treat brain injuries. And there you have it.
That's disturbing overall, I would say.
Stop drinking Red Bull.
But it's interesting that they're more susceptible because their brains are still developing, and that you're more likely to get brain trauma as a result.
Well, if you think about it, it's like taking speed.
Yeah.
You know,
I remember when I was in college, no dose was the thing to take. Like, you got a test, you got to stay.
I have no idea what that is.
You don't know what no dose is.
It was
caffeine pills. This is before caffeine pills.
No dose.
You never had no dose.
So having excess amount of coffee can do the same, I wonder.
Well, yeah, you can sit there and drink coffee and ruin your stomach lining. Or you can just have a caffeine pill.
No, I mean, if it has the same effects as Red Bull in terms of TBI.
That's the interesting thing. Is it the caffeine or is it the Red Bull and all the nastiness in the Red Bull?
True, because Red Bull comes with a lot of chemicals.
And it's nasty.
I say go back to the original Coca-Cola and all will be good.
I think Red Bull is nasty. Everybody knows it's nasty.
You know,
it's just a nasty
drink. The other day, Mike, I had a root beer.
Yeah.
I had root beer the other day, and it's called... This is not your grandfather's root beer, and it has like 8% alcohol in it.
What?
But
I didn't know they had alcoholic root beer.
I swear, I didn't know it either. I mean, it's like, hey, check out this root beer. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is really good. And they go, well, now look at this. It's 8% alcohol. I go, well, you got to be kidding me.
What kind?
It's probably one of the best root beers I've ever drank. It's
of
really
course.
Scary.
How could you know?
How would you know? It's like... It's scary, man. Who are they trying to turn? You know, that's going to be the new thing. Things are going to go from power drinks to like stuff like that now, where it'll be like no more power drinks. It's just have a root beer with 8% alcohol.
Well, it's almost like the coolers that they sell. So,
right,
the mixed coolers. I guess they're trying to follow in those footsteps to make more money, of course.
But I mean, I could see where you don't even realize.
that you're drinking liquor. I'm saying with the, if it's 8%, you know, this root beer, you have to check it out, see what I'm talking about, because it's just like, it's wild.
What is a root beer called? I've never heard of alcoholic root beer.
It's called, this is not your grandfather or not your father's root beer.
Interesting.
That's the name of it.
I mean, it's just a matter of time before Tropicana orange juice comes with this, you know, comes mixed with coconut
with
rum.
Vodka?
Coconut
this
rum.
Is not your, this is not Florida orange juice.
You will get screwed. This is a real screwdriver.
Yeah, it's a real screwdriver mix, you know. It's like, this is not Florida orange juice. This is not Tropicana. So, Mike, you didn't like Red Bull? You don't like Red Bull?
You know, there's nothing to like. I mean, I may like the effects, but it's nasty.
It's just a weird-tasting thing. It's just nasty.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty nasty. That's why people need to mix it with alcohol.
Or something.
TVRs. Tequila, vodka, Red Bull. That's what people do. They call them TVRs.
Oh, really?
Yep.
How do you know about this, Jenny?
Because I have crazy English friends
that
taught me this.
Whatever.
No. There is
Jenny.
No whatever.
Oh, yes.
You look up
spill
Jenny,
out,
queen
club.
Of the TVR parties.
Spill it out, Breakfast Club.
I swear, yeah. I am innocent.
You.
Jenny
you know
TVR Caracalla.
Don't you forget about me. Let's drink some tequila.
WBAI, and I'm speaking with Michael Barnett and co-founder Hal Ruby about a new film called Becoming Bulletproof. Michael, Will, welcome to WBAI.
Thanks. Hey, thanks for having us.
All right, well, I'm going to actually start with you, Will, and I want to get a sense of how you started this organization and what the premise was going in.
Well, we started I guess it's been about 12 years we've been making films out in California. And it started because I loved the community. I love being a part of groups of people that sort of move and think and talk and bring different sort of creative personalities to the table. And it was just very, very intriguing. And I thought it would be a wonderful platform to make a different kind of movie from. I think what makes us unique is our tenets of, we never charge anyone to come and no one pays to be there. We don't have any sort of social hierarchy between whether someone has a disability or not. We are at our core a creative group of diverse friends who are passionate about lifelong friendship and making movies together. And then the different personalities that are attracted to that and have ended up in our film troupe sort of bring what I think is what makes our movies uniquely interesting. Our first project was, I think it was 12 years ago, 2000, I guess that puts us at around 2004, 2005. And the first one we did was a soap opera. And we got together we had a party at our friend Lucy Dahl's house and literally just invited everyone we knew to the party and just asked everybody to give no more than $500. And we raised $17,000 that night. Our first movie. And everyone was just excited about the project. I mean, if people kind of knew us. We've been gathering this community from other organizations and camps that we've been a part of for many years. So, you know, they felt like we could do it. And I think everyone was very interested in what would come out of it and wanted to be a part of it.
Now, let me ask you, Michael, how did you first find out about Zeno Mountain Farm, and what made you decide that you wanted this to be your second feature documentary?
I had a very good friend who had been volunteering with Zeno and Will for years, Susie Barrett. She's the comedian in our movie, in the documentary. And she, you know, she's been with the gang for a long, long time, and she'd been asking me for years to come around. She had a thought that I would be interested, and I sort of
found excuses for a long time to not come around. You know, I was busy and whatnot. And I was really making an excuse to just because I had no idea, I had no experience with disability whatsoever. And finally, she convinced me to come to one of their screenings of one of the films they made. And I showed up, and it was a huge party. And I had no idea what to expect. I can't even remember what I thought back then. It was like 4 or 5 years ago. And I saw a movie that sort of had everything I loved about cinema in it. You know, it was like a real indie guerrilla piece of filmmaking that's full of like sadness and joy. And it happened to star a bunch of people with disability, and it kind of messed me up. You know, I had so many questions, and I was so confused. And so I showed up at camp the next day and just started talking to Will and Pete and Vanessa and Isla about what they do and why they do it and how they do it. And, you know, we started kind of slowly talking about the notion of telling their story and making a film, because what they do is it's so interesting and it's so different than, as you mentioned, than anything else I'd ever seen or even heard of. And we spent about a year kind of getting to know each other, you know, and I would say vetting one another, you know, and kind of gaining each other's trust and seeing where, you know, where we stood, you know, as humans. And, you know, slowly but surely, we all kind of came to believe that this was kind of the right fit. And, yeah, and, you know, they decided to make a Western, and I was like, fantastic. That sounds like a great...
You tell a great story about people who are telling stories. How receptive were all the camp people to having a documentary made about the fact that they're making a film?
I mean, Will can speak to some of that, but when I walked in there, some people were completely freaked out and some people were totally open. I mean, it was 45 people, so there was a 45 different reactions. And so, you know, what they do is it's really personal, and it's actually really private. And they kind of refer to what they do as a being in a bubble. And it is, you know, by and large. These people all come together, and they accomplish the impossible. And they do it through, you know, love and determination. And to have a camera come in there is intrusive, even though they're using cameras constantly to tell stories. But to have a camera come and just, you know, witness what they're doing is very intrusive. So... I was terrified too. I mean, so incredibly emotional those first few days of shooting. I was so overwhelmed, you know, by what was happening. But Will was actually always pretty down. His brother was a little more intrepid. He asked most of the questions of like, do we trust this man?
Well, you know, again, I have to say one of the things that came out, and then I definitely want to hear your answer to or your thoughts on this, Will, is that it is a family. So I have to assume, like any family, you're protective of them.
Yeah, and it's funny, I'd forgotten about this, but Mike, we had like a great meeting with Mike, and yeah, we were very interested because it just seemed like another filmmaking opportunity, you know, sort of like we see it as a creative project. It wasn't the idea of it being some sort of an expose or anything that wouldn't work with representing us well immediately went away as soon as we talked to Mike. So that was off the table, but I think everybody saw it as like this is what we do. We're a film community. This is another creative project that we get to be a part of, and just from a different side, and so that was intriguing. But we did pull together sort of after we met with Mike. We all met and we just talked about it freestyle, and everybody had questions, and we took those back to Mike, and we went back and forth a whole bunch of times. But at the end of the day, everybody was pretty excited about it.
The most difficult part, I thought this film was going to be easy, no-brainer. I go in there for a few weeks, I make a movie, I shoot it, I go into the edit bay, and I have this great making of film, you know, about the making of a movie, which is always fascinating, you know, a scene in a way we haven't seen it before. That couldn't be further from the truth. I spent 3 years making the movie. You know, we ended up like starting and stopping because there was so much that I had to learn. I think there's so much that Will and Pete learned about themselves and what they do through the making of this film. But there's so much I had to learn about, you know, the disability community and how it works. And more importantly, the disability rights movement, you know, because I think our film really is a civil rights movie. I think it's a film about inclusion and equality. And I didn't know that when I started making it. And I think it was just a refinement process of getting in there, shooting, having long, long discussions for months and months on end about what our film is truly about, going back out, shooting a little more, going home with some people. So it took a long time. You know, we shot for 2.5 years and we edited for 2 years and we took long breaks so we could have long, long conversations, philosophical conversations about what the heck we were trying to do and accomplish. So that was hard, and I didn't know it was going to be that hard. But I'm glad it was that hard, you know. I really am, because I'm really proud of the film. And if we had done it any faster, it wouldn't be the film it is. And for me, the most rewarding part is the response. Everywhere we go, man, it's standing O's, you know, which I love. It's just the audience reception for the film has been remarkable. So
I think it's funny because I think it's the same sort of the two sides of the same coin. I think prior to seeing the movie, the hardest part, the hardest part is before people see it, they think they know what it is, and sort of communicating with people, people think they've seen this movie. They think they've seen the disability movie, and it's going to be sappy, and it's going to be heartwarming, and it's going to be, you know, these able-bodied people feeling very good about helping these, you know, disabled people. And it is a heartwarming movie, and it is very, you know, emotional and beautiful and all those things, but it's not what people think it is. And I think that's been frustrating, because people, you know, they go into it thinking one thing and trying to convince people that to go in with a completely open mind has been complicated. And I think it's made it more difficult to get it out there. And then, but on the other side of it, after people have seen it, what's been the most rewarding part is having the conversations. Because I think it is a nuanced movie. It's a movie that challenges people's sensibilities around this issue in a very, very gentle way. And I have thoroughly enjoyed, after screenings, talking to people about their reactions and what they're experiencing and where their minds are changing. There's a moment in the movie where Susie kind of explains her personal arc. And I think that, to Mike's credit, that's put in there at a very, very good part when the audience is also sort of grappling with what they're experiencing. And I appreciate that about the film and the guys, and, you know, Mike for all that he did for that, because it inspires the conversations that I want to have about disability.
I found the movie life affirming, and I smiled as much as I cried. I was moved. I was challenged as so many, many different things. And you must say this a lot. There was a Rolodex of people in my mind thinking, oh, so-and-so needs to see this. Oh, so-and-so has kids and she needs to see that, you know? So there are a lot of people I feel need to see your film. Have you gotten reactions like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great.
I love it.
That's
take more.
Michael, when did you first know you wanted to be a storyteller?
Early, I think pretty early, you know, to my mother's credit, when everybody was sort of sitting around watching Saturday morning cartoons, you know, we were watching Harold and Maude and The Godfather. And I think when I was in middle school, I saw Roger and Me, Michael Moore's film, and I didn't even really understand what I saw completely. It was incredible, you know. It wasn't like any documentary I'd ever seen. And through these little kind of moments, it started culminating, certainly through my teen years. And then I went to college and was studying something unrelated to film. And, you know, by my junior year, I was like, what am I doing? I'm just wasting my time here. I'm done. I'm going to Los Angeles. I'm going to go make movies. And I did. And that's what I do.
What about you, Will? When did you first know you wanted to be a storyteller?
I'd say around my college years, working in theater with this same community. I didn't realize that I just love putting up the story. But what I think it's more, for me, it's the story is secondary to the way it's told, and to sort of I love bringing this community and putting them on stage or on film, because I think it sort of sheds a new angle. And none of our films are ever about disability, but they star people with disabilities. And our sort of take on it is that usually Hollywood movies that involve disability are people who don't have disabilities pretending to have a disability in a movie about disability that are always really sappy. And we thought, and this is what I love about the stories that we tell and the way we tell them, is we take that model and turn it completely upside down. And so I think that beyond the story that we tell, there's a lot of information in there that's important.
Oh, I agree. As a matter of fact, I think the largest disability is the one that the audience goes in with their preconceived notion of what people with disabilities can or cannot do.
You're tuned to Listener Sponsored Radio. WBAI. The name of the show.
Night Shift.
So you have a last story for us.
I do. I do. And I completely agree with this one.
Chris, are you still there?
And right here. Here I am.
Rock me like a hurricane. All right. I had to get there. If you're sitting down, don't sit still. New research suggests. Fidget for your health. Scientists found that increased...
Fidget for your health.
Fidget for your health. Found that increased risk of mortality from longer sitting times compared to more active women and those who considered themselves as moderately or very fidgety. So basically what they're saying is you should move around. It's okay. In a study published today in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, a team of researchers co-led by the University of Leeds report that an increased risk of mortality from sitting for long periods was only found in those who consider themselves very occasional fidgeters. They found no increased risk of mortality from longer sitting times compared to more active women in those who considered themselves as moderately or very fidgety. The study examined...
Fidgety. Have you ever been called fidgety? Kind of fidgety.
Always.
Are you fidgety?
I am fidgety.
You're fidgety.
I'm always. My legs are always shaking.
You're a fidgety kind of guy.
Always. But not because I'm nervous.
Because you've got a lot of energy.
I have way too much energy.
I understand. I can help you.
I don't need Red Bull. Study co-led author Professor Janet Cade has said that while further research is needed, the findings raise questions about whether the negative associations with fidgeting, such as rudeness or lack of concentration, should persist if such simple movements are beneficial for our health. Even among adults who meet recommended physical activity levels and who sleep for 8 hours per night, it is possible to spend the vast majority of the day, up to 15 hours, sitting
fidgeting.
Down.
Mm.
This study builds on growing evidence suggesting that a sedentary lifestyle is bad for your health.
Sedentary.
I'm Canadian.
It's okay.
Even if you're physically active outside work, breaks in sitting time have previously been shown to improve markers of good health, such as body mass index and your body's glucose and insulin responses. But until now, no study has ever examined whether fidgeting might modify an association between sitting time and death rates.
Whoa.
Interesting. Another study gathered information on a wide range of eating patterns of more than 35,000 women aged 35 to 69 who are living in the UK. The new study analysis data from a follow-up survey sent to the same women, which included questions on health behaviors, chronic disease, physical activity levels, and fidgeting. More than 14,000 responses were received.
Wow.
Our results support the suggestion that it's best to avoid sitting still for long periods of time, and even fidgeting may offer enough of a break to make a difference.
Wow. So fidgeting is literally good for you.
So what they're saying is fidget for your health.
Fidget for health.
Fidget for health.
And you're fidgety.
I'm always fidgety.
Is that your middle name?
No. That's
Jenny Fidgety Caracaya.
Definitely not my middle name.
Jenny Fidgety Caracaya.
No.
No.
I just can't sit still.
You're fidgety.
No. Sit.
No, I'm clearly like a fidgety guy. As I've gotten older, I'm a little more mellow, but I'm a total fidgety. Like, I when I was young, like, I couldn't, like, walk.
Yeah.
We had to walk 3 blocks. I'd have to run.
Yeah.
Like, I just have to.
My mother had an expression for me. It's like your butt is on fire. You can't sit still.
Your butt is on fire.
Yes.
Can I spread that around? Jenny Caracaya.
Hey.
Butt is on fire. Okay, I'm sorry.
That's a metaphor.
Your mother said it.
That's
your
a metaphor. Saw it. What's it a, sounds different
I
in Armenian.
I got a joke for you. What's a metaphor? To keep the cows in. Chris, can I ask you, were you fidgety as a child?
Yeah, I'm fidgety now.
You're pretty fidgety
right now.
You're fidgety.
I'm the fidgety.
You're the fidgety.
Yeah, little rascal. Fidget.
Well, you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI. I want to thank Jenny Karakaya. Jenny.
Thank you for having
show,
me.
So you enjoyed it? Did you enjoy
I
yourself?
I did. I always enjoy the show.
Didn't it go by quick?
It does, considering it's almost 3 a.m. And
yes,
I would normally...
You wouldn't feel it. You'd be sleeping now.
Be out like a light.
That's right.
I'm still fidgety.
Well, you're fidgety.
I'm still fidgety.
Well, see, the thing is, when you finish a show like this, you're like, you're awake. You know, you don't know what to do with yourself when you're done with the show.
I know what to do with myself when I'm done with the show.
You know... She knows what to do with herself.
Yeah, she knows what to do with herself.
Fidgety Jenny. All right. Well,
exactly what to do with herself.
You can follow us on Twitter.
We can start the show right now.
At Night Shift, NITESHIFTZ.
That's how the show should have started.
Twitter.
Yeah.
And you can follow us on Facebook, NITESHIFT. You can like us. You can go. I will be at the socially relevant fundraising event. I'll be the guest of honor. So you can come meet me, sit and have a 3-course meal and some wine.
When's that?
Wednesday.
Nice.
All right.
Go to the Night Shift Facebook page and you'll see all the info.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Well, thank you for coming, Jenny.
Thank you.